We're going to go ahead and get started. We'll call this meeting to order. Ms. Dulles, will you please call the roll?
Vice Chair Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler. Trustee Nathan Hayes.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero.
Here.
Trustee Bob Pritchard.
Here.
Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Trustee Eric Wasowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Wheeler Coleman.
Here. May the record show that Trustee John Butler just walked in the door.
John?
Mr. Brady, will you please confirm that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Mr. Chair, appropriate notices have been provided by the university and we have reached quorum.
May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
The motion, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Hearing none, the motion is approved. May I have a motion to amend that motion in order to approve the consent agenda as follows? Information items 7B1 through 7B11. May I have a motion, please? May I have a second?
Second.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Hearing none, the motion is approved. Agenda item 4, public comment. This is the portion of our agenda where we recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and the Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with a parliamentarian. Mr. Brady, have you received any timely request to address this meeting?
Mr. Chair, I have received no requests.
No requests. Is that a record?
I think that's a first.
It's the first in a long time. Does anybody want to talk?
The mic is open.
We got open mic. We want to sing open mic. I guess so. Wow. So let's go to agenda item number 5 then, the chair comments. And before I open up the floor for the chairs, the members of our university advisory committee to speak to us, I do have a letter or a statement that I'd like to read for the group. And so bear with me. I understand we've got about a few hours anyway, so. To my NIU family, in 2009, I received a phone call from a fellow alum asking if I would consider becoming a member of NIU's alumni board. At the time, I've been back to campus probably 20 years prior. At the end of the conversation, it was clear to me that the university that I loved so much and that shaped my life was calling me back home. There was work to be done. And I joined NIU's alumni board. And in a very short period of time, I was also voted as the vice president of the alumni board before I got another call. And that call was requesting that I consider applying and becoming a member of the board of trustees. I originally said no, somewhat fearful of the commitment that would be required of a trustee. And after a long conversation, I realized that the university that I loved so much was calling me and was calling me to take on another role at another level. For the last 7 years, I served on NIU's Board of Trustees. I was appointed twice by Governor Quinn, first in 2012 to complete Manny Sanchez's last year of his term, and again in 2013 for my own six-year term. Throughout the last 7 years, I enjoyed serving and giving back to an institution that had a special place in my life. During this time, I had the privilege of working side by side with committed and dedicated trustees who have become my friends and have helped me develop as a person and as a leader and as a trustee. I will be forever grateful for the current and prior trustees' support and the support that they provided me and their commitment to this institution. I've also had the privilege to spend countless hours with our president, Dr. Leeksa Freeman. And when I said countless hours, as chair, Dr. Freeman and I would meet every Friday morning early. And I think we've met every Friday morning for the past 17, 18 months, maybe missing maybe two or three Fridays. And I think that had something to do with a holiday or something of that nature. I am so proud of Dr. Freeman and the fact that she's our new president. And I'm certain with her leadership, NIU will accomplish great things. For almost 10 years, I have volunteered my three T's, my time, my talent, and my treasure to NIU. Some may consider my three T's as small potatoes, while others may consider them a great sacrifice. I would classify them as my gift back, soaked in love for a university striving for greatness. I have enjoyed my journey in spite of the twists and turns, bumps and bruises, but most of all, I enjoyed the relationships that I've developed and I will cherish for the rest of my life. Throughout my tenure, I have tried to serve with the honest intent to add value and make a real difference to NIU. I have tried to be a role model, especially for the students here at NIU. I have tried to speak truth to power and even truth to bullies who pretend to have the best interests of this university. I have tried to remind the non-believers that I am a proud product of NIU. And I am a true product of NIU's mission, and that we should not steer away from its mission. I have also tried to break down barriers and stereotypes. I believe that everyone sitting in a leadership role must be all in and to give their very best and do their very best within their ability to make decisions that will move NIU forward. After a long and extensive examination of my personal and professional career, I have come to the conclusion that my time as trustee should end. Therefore, I will not petition the governor-elect for a new six-year term as trustee. I plan to complete the remaining of my term, which expires January 21st, 2019, and at that time, I will no longer serve as a trustee of NIU. As many of you know, our bylaws have a succession plan where the vice chair becomes the new chair. And I trust that Trustee Barsima will accept that responsibility and become the chair of the Board of Trustees in January of the new year. So therefore, today will be my last board meeting as chair because this is our last official meeting until February. I leave with a heavy heart, knowing that greatness is in our destiny. I leave knowing that there's still more work to be done. We have more work to do with our enrollment, with our finances, with our facility, with our graduation rate, and yes, with our lack of diversity in our administration, our faculty, as well as our financial spend. I leave knowing that we are in good hands with our new president and our fellow trustees, as well as the hardworking, committed staff members of this great institution. We will continue, and they will continue, to address the critical and pressing needs of this university to move it forward. I want to thank all of you for allowing me to serve with love. And after my term expires in January, I will continue to make myself available to Dr. Freeman to help move NIU forward. It just can't be another 6-year commitment. I will always be a Husky, and I will always serve with pride. Go Husky, and thank you, NIU. Thank you. Trustee Barsima, you know what I would love for you to do? I'd love for you to chair this meeting. You want to chair the rest of this meeting?
No, I will. I will.
Okay, we'll let you make a couple of comments then.
Another 45 days or so. I've known Wheeler a long time, since he was in braces.
I see like a lone.
I have been on the board now going on 2 years, here this coming January, and I have been blessed to serve under two chairs for the first 6 months of my tenure, John Butler, and for the last last 18 months, Wheeler. I've been able to observe, two wonderful people who have led NIU and the Board of Trustees through some very tough times. And they've done it with grace. But the one thing that I would say that when I talk about leadership, you talk about the credibility of the leader. And when I look at Wheeler, what I see are four things from a credibility standpoint that I've really grown to admire and learn from. The first mark of credibility of a leader is do what you say you're going to do. Students are always asking me, how do I become a credible person and how do I become a person who is trusted? And my response to them is always, do what you say you're going to do. And Wheeler has always been somebody who has done what he has said he was going to do. And I've really come to respect that of you, Wheeler. Second thing that I've always admired of Wheeler, and I've had a chance now close up to admire it for the last 18 months, is his ability and willingness to call out injustices, be it against our students or involving the administration of our university or FOIA requests or whatever it might be. He has always been willing to take a tough stance when a tough stance was needed. Another mark is fairness. Wheeler is an extremely fair person, and along with that is my fourth point and my last point, which is his willingness and ability to listen to other people's points of view. You don't get a chance to observe the Board of Trustees in closed session, but it can get rather feisty in closed session because we have eight very talented people up on this platform and you have eight strong opinions in a closed session on whatever the topic might be, and it would be easy for Wheeler to just dive in and say, no, here is the direction we're going to go in. I'm the chair. But he has never done that. He has always been willing to listen to the different points of view that sit around this table and help us to come to a common platform so that when we walk out of the room, we're all on the same page. And so all those things I've really grown to admire about you, Wheeler, and I've learned from you. So for the last 18 months that you've been my leader and our leader here on the Board of Trustees, and for the 7-plus years you have served as a trustee, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I guess this is our only chance to talk, right? We won't have another opportunity maybe to recognize you, so I'll jump in. First, I'm chuckling as I look at John Butler with a bunch of typed notes, and I'm scribbling on the back of a piece of paper. Wheeler is an awesome human being. I mean, that's just the word that comes to mind. I mean, a dear friend. That he and I would have not known each other at all. Got introduced at the Ohio State football game a handful of years ago when I was first appointed. And you talked about the closed sessions, Dennis, being contentious now, or, you know, high energy. They were very, very much in the prior administration, prior board for sure. And Wheeler and I became fast friends in that process. Not maybe not immediately, but we became pretty close through that process. And the terms and the words that you use with leadership and fairness and balance and his qualities of a listener, I'm 100% in line with. Just a genuine, smart, fair, capable, loving, wonderful person. You will be missed greatly, and I surely do hope that you stick tight to the university. You can be a resource for us in a lot of ways, and maybe even more so outside, right? So we will miss you on the board. I surely hope I do not miss you as a friend as we go through the journey of life. Thank you.
Thank you. I would love for us to move on to the next agenda item, if that's okay. That's good with that?
No.
Is it still on?
No. Actually, I'm not good with that.
Okay. Trustee.
So you can't get off that easy. You know, it's I've known you for 2 years, and I'd heard about you. We come from the same industry, so it's kind of weird that we don't really know each other that well. But I did get to know you when I first came on here, and I, you know, when we first came on to the board, when Veronica and Dennis and I came on, we didn't know what to expect, and Wheeler and John kind of tutored us along a little bit here, and I saw a board that, you know, was not unified, and I had heard rumors of maybe, you know, factions and things like that. And what's happened here is that, you know, we don't always get along, but I think what you've helped us figure out is that it's the university that's the most important, and I think that's one of the big things that I've learned from you. You encourage us to challenge each other, especially when you get in a closed session, and we will challenge. You've always been very willing to listen. And I know I work with a lot of type A personalities. I'm involved with a lot of type A personalities. Usually you don't get to this area if you're not a type A personality. And usually a lot of times those people don't listen, but you do. And that's the thing I respect about you quite a bit. There's one thing that really kind of sticks out to me that, and this happened maybe a little over a year ago, but when we voted on our out-of-state tuition to make it the same as for, you know, for the other states, for people to come in here. And I'll never forget walking out from, and we talked about this, and it just seemed very clear that this is something that we should do. And I remember having a discussion with John Butler in the hallway over here, and John said, you know what, I didn't think this would ever happen. This would have taken years, and we just all of a sudden, boom, we did it. And I felt like we did that because of your leadership and to help pull all these pulling all of us together to do that, I think, is great. I mean, these are all, I look forward to, let's say we're in the same industry. We never get a chance to talk, though, about industries. I'm looking forward to us talking about business other than NIU, which would be great. But we never get a chance to do that. But I've had a chance to view you personally as well. And I had a chance to see you at a, you know, a very vulnerable moment, you know, your father passed. And that was an extremely emotional moment for you. It was emotional for me as well because it reminded me of my father as well. And I saw a lot of just some, you know, you just see something that comes out of people when that happens. And then finally in Detroit. Wheeler and I were in Detroit the other night. And for those of you that had not seen this football game, it didn't look good for us in up until about the middle of the third quarter. And toward the end of the game, we came through, and we ran down the stairs. So we were up in a box, and we ran four flights of stairs down onto the field. And we hugged, and it was like you and I and Sean Frazier hugged to the point. And if you, I don't know if you've ever been where somebody's hugging you, and it's Wheeler, me, and Sean. And it's to the point where, okay, now I'm a little uncomfortable because this has been going on for a long time. And we were just so happy. So, Wheeler, we got a chance to see your Detroit because you spent a lot of time there, and we had a lot of fun. So, cigar bars. I hadn't come home with a smoky jacket in a long time. Thank you. And but you know, I just thought about that later on. I thought, God, I missed that. So, but thank you, and thank you for your service, and we're going to miss you.
Appreciate it.
I have to do this to you too, but just that, you know, it's hard on a bunch of different levels. I mean, I didn't know Wheeler before I became a trustee as well, and just from what I've understood from John too, the board itself was not always as functional as it is now, and the you know every one of us, I feel. No offense to everyone else. It's just the dynamics and the environment, everything like that, right? But each one of us plays such a unique role and just such a critical, almost puzzle piece, right, to what we do. And bringing just unique perspectives and experiences. And yours is so incredibly critical. And it's almost like, what are we going to do without you? You know, your experience of being a person of color who is an alum, who went through the CHANCE program, who rose the ranks, who became a leader in his community and his family at the university, it's just that is not easy to find. And you took that and you brought all of that passion to life on the board for the community and the students. And that means a lot. You've led the group, even when I knew you didn't want things to go a certain way, but you listened to everybody, and even against where you maybe wanted things to go, you led with nothing but integrity and true leadership. And that's, again, hard to find, although I know Dennis will be great as well. But I do obviously appreciate your path here, and I wish you the best of luck in your journey moving forward, and looking forward to working with you in your new capacity here as whatever that becomes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll try to be brief. Everyone has said things that I would have said as well. Wheeler has a wonderful profile and has marshaled all of the wisdom of that profile in your leadership. When Wheeler came on to the board, I don't know if any of you remember, but it was probably the worst time that the board had ever had. In terms of being contentious and conflict-ridden. He laid low but worked behind the scenes to repair relationships and restore fairness to the manner in which the board behaved toward each other. And I was a recipient of the benefits of that when I became chair myself after serving quite some time on the board. And jump forward to the summer of 2017, there couldn't have been a better time for someone of Wheeler's background and skill to take over the board, because he did essentially the same thing after a very difficult period where the erosion of trust and the need for repair was was on a larger stage, and he was able to manage that very well, and even leading the board into a place where it paved the way for the decision to consider the incumbent president for the permanent presidency, which was a very challenging thing to do at that time, but you did so beautifully, and I think we all owe you a great deal of thanks for your leadership.
Shall we make it complete?
Yes.
I was surprised when I received your letter a week or so ago, because you have become a real fixture on this board. You add the stability that many members have already mentioned and that cohesive leadership. When I joined the board, I came here at a time when the board had the harmony that it had not had in a few years before. And it had a vision and direction. And you had a great acting president that it was easy to vote for in a permanent role. And your leadership has meant much to this university, and I hope in your future roles that you will stay engaged, you will continue to offer your expertise and experiences and the love of this institution. You're a great role model. Thank you.
I'm
going to
finish this up here.
No, actually, I'm going to talk after you.
Okay, all right. So I'll keep my piece brief, but I really just want to say how much I appreciate you and how much you helped me kind of get acquainted to the board. Coming in, especially at the time I did, there was a lot going on. And you were the first one to call me and congratulate me on the board when I did receive this position. And you're always the first one to kind of make sure I understand what's going on. So, and you mentioned in your statement how you strive to be a role model. And I definitely look up to you and the leader that you are. And you've definitely taught me how to be an effective leader and an effective trustee. So I appreciate that. And I hope to stay in touch with you in the years to come.
So I know my boss didn't want me to speak, but since he's only boss until the end of January, I'm just going to take the microphone. You know, I've known Wheeler as the acting president and president, and, you know, in our relationship as, you know, board chair and president of the university. But I've also worked with Wheeler under two other presidents and in two other positions as vice president for research and as executive vice president and provost. And I've always appreciated Wheeler's ability to put the institution first and to understand that the institution is the students. But beyond that, the way that Wheeler has always made the Husky family his family and his family Huskies is something that I admire more than anything. I remember the day in 2012 when you were sworn in as a trustee, and it was your wife, Sharon, who came to swear you in. And I remember being at a donor event at the Art Gallery in Bronzeville and having four generations of Colemans there to meet our students and to celebrate the accomplishments of our students. And I can think of so many barbecues and athletic events and arts events where your beautiful children were there and Sharon was there. And it makes me feel wonderful to know that although you're leaving the board, you will always be a Husky. You and Sharon and the children and the grandbaby will always be part of the Husky family. And I look forward to seeing you a little more relaxed with a bigger smile on your face among your family at all these events. But we will be asking you to support us, and I know that you'll be there the way you were when you got those two phone calls. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I know we have work to do, so after 30 minutes, let's... Yes.
So Sharon swore you in. Did she always swear at you then, or... Does that just happen here, or is that at home too?
It happens all the time. So once a judge, always a judge, right? I want to welcome the University Advisory Committee representatives that are present today, and I'd like to provide you with an opportunity to speak. More than welcome.
Thank you, Trustee Coleman. I just wanted to briefly, end of semester, recognize the faculty in general for all the great work they have done. We are in, you know, three or four times a year, one of the most stressful times for probably faculty, but especially students as well. And I want to recognize our faculty for helping to shepherd the students through this process and work towards their success. On an individual note, this is me speaking. I have only worked with you for a very short time in this position. You mentioned the three T's that you have given. That is phenomenal. Most people are willing to give one of those things. You've given all three freely and fully, and that's a rare thing. So thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Doderline, Supporter Professional Staff Council President. And before going into my formal comments, which, given that we're already deeper into the meeting, I apologize, are a bit longer today than they normally would be, but I'll keep them moving. I do also want to thank you. I think that in your role, throughout your time as a trustee, but then especially in your role as chair, you've really championed shared governance and included faculty and staff in as much as you can. And that's really been clear and very much appreciated by staff. One of the items on today's agenda is going to be a presentation from HR on the differences and similarities between supportive professional staff and civil service. And as I understand it, I believe it was a topic specifically requested by members of the board. I thank you for that interest. I imagine a lot of the interest specifically ties to the new exemption procedures manual from the State University Civil Service System Merit Board that officially went into effect on October 1st of this year. I've mentioned it several times in previous commenting opportunities here and in just about any chance I'm given to make public comment about the concerns facing supportive professional staff on campus. There are a few items that will be covered within the presentation that I wanted to take a moment to provide specific thoughts on. Before commenting further, I want to make sure I note a few key things. The administration, especially President Freeman, Acting Provost McCord, and Chief of Staff Matt Streb have been incredibly receptive to hearing the concerns of SPS, and I know President Freeman has been a very active champion at the state level. Trustee John Butler, who serves as our rep to the SUCS Merit Board, has been incredible in his commitment of time and energy towards better understanding the concerns of all parties on campus and relaying to the state level the impact this is having on our campus. Thank you to the administration and to Trustee Butler for all those efforts and openness to conversation. I also want to note that in a role I held prior to my time at NIU, I served for several years as an HR manager for a large retailer, and I understand all too well how easy it is for problems and concerns to automatically be blamed on HR. Though I think there are definitely processes within HR that can be tightened up and improved, and I look forward to the outcomes of the review of HR processes that Provost McCord has been helping to oversee, I want to commend HR for their efforts to help ensure NIU is compliant with the new procedures, especially at a time when I know that they are working with tighter resources and smaller staffs, as is true all across campus. In fact, most of the concerns related to potential shifts from SPS to service relate to two key things. One factor is communication. And HR and university administration have been working to address this, not just as it pertains to this matter, as I know President Freeman has noted as a top priority the improvement of communication, but across the board in general. And recent communication efforts in October have already gone a long way in improving understanding that staff have of the potential impact of these changes, and I thank them for those efforts. The second factor is a hierarchical view of faculty and staff ingrained here at NIU and, frankly, at higher education institutions across the nation. Long before any discussion of a new procedure update for exempting of positions, and long before my time at NIU, there has unfortunately always been a sense of hierarchy that places faculty at the very top, supportive professional staff at the next level, and then civil service at the very bottom of the heap. Whenever supportive professional staff have come to me with arguments of why they should not be shifted to civil service due to the advanced degrees they hold or the specialized nature of the work that they do, I frankly have not been particularly understanding of that argument. Staff within the civil service classifications hold a wide variety of degree and professional backgrounds and bring so much to the table. Some of the most competent, hardworking, caring, and student-focused professionals I work with on this campus are civil service, and I am proud to stand with them and serve NIU. And that's really a key in my mind, faculty, staff, instructors, GAs, undergraduate student workers. When it comes down to it, we are all employees of NIU, hopefully giving our three T's here to ensure that the students of NIU receive a quality education and the tools they need to succeed. And each of us contributes to that own goal and does so with pride. But when I push back to those SPS colleagues who make claims that seem to relate to status, they will note that they agree, and it's unfortunate, but that it stems from a history of working to be accepted at the table of matters related to student policies and procedures, especially those more academic in nature, perhaps things related to academic advising as an example, and being told that their input isn't needed because they are staff. Prior to the title of supporter professional staff, SPS were noted as faculty no rank, and those folks who were fighting for a spot at the table had to use that faculty rank, no rank name to be more welcomed and to be heard. Though this has improved in recent years and I have found myself much more welcomed at the table, I know that I have experienced times when the staff voice in general is not as represented and that the civil service staff colleagues with me have felt stifled in what they could say and how their voices were heard. We need to do better with this. We have come a long way, but we need to do better. And these discussions of potential shifts to civil service are a great time to change the rhetoric around how we see faculty and staff on campus. Another element that is weighing heavily on the minds of supportive professional staff facing a potential shift to civil service is their seniority. As you will learn in today's presentation, within the SPS classification, for regular non-temporary SPS, once in a role for a minimum of 3 years, we are contracted to receive a year's notice for termination. This is a huge benefit for SPS and one that allows people time to determine next steps in their career, often shifting with NIU, though sometimes going to roles outside of campus, but providing some decided comfort in a tenuous time. With a shift to civil service, though the notice window in most cases is only 30 days, there are also bumping rights based on seniority that give people additional protections that can be far greater than the benefit of a year's notice. But employees who are currently in SPS roles and shifting to civil service are not always being given seniority equivalent to their entire time at NIU, as it depends on how their years of service are seen relative to the specific civil service class to which they will be shifted. In theory, someone with 20-plus years of service to NIU could be told that their seniority in class is only in the single digits. To my mind, especially if there's a possibility that their position was inaccurately exempted in the first place years ago, though I'll admit in the case of a 20-plus year employee that might be less likely to be the case, their seniority should be extended as much as possible, and I urge the university to be as open to seniority considerations as possible. Additionally, there are certain professional development privileges that come with supportive professional staff classification, such as consideration for sabbaticals. I do not see any reason that the opportunity for sabbaticals can't be made available to all staff of NIU, and I intend to work with my operating staff colleagues to put forward a proposal for a change in the appropriate university policies to ensure that all faculty and staff are given the same access to the right to further professional development opportunities. I feel this change will only stand to benefit the entire campus and will go a long way in helping supportive professional staff facing a change to civil service feel more comfortable with the potential shift. Within the information you received today are numbers which show representation of individuals and supportive professional staff and civil service classifications. Not surprisingly, these numbers have gone down in recent years, and given enrollment trends, the decline in numbers has been a responsible and necessary shift. But in looking at some historical figures, I was actually less jarred to think about the shift from 954 SPS in 2012 to 692 SPS at the time of today's presentation, and more concerned to look at the fact that as of September 18th of this year, when we happened to collect the numbers of SPS so we could reapportion divisions within the council, we had 711 SPS employees at that time. Again, as of today, we have 692 SPS. That's a loss of 19 employees within the rank in less than 3 months. Now, if all 19 of those employees shifted to civil service, there's no loss to the university at all. But I know personally of at least three instances where those people left NIU, and I'm confident that more than just three of those 19 people left NIU. Again, in less than 3 months. We are losing talented staff from the university, and I do think the issues of shifts from SPS to civil service and the stress that has caused some people is a contributing factor to some of that loss, and I hope we can stem that tide. I think if we can help ensure people shifting from SPS to civil service maintain as much seniority as possible and can work to improve the climate on campus so that all faculty and staff are seen as the vital contributors to the campus climate that we all are, we will go a long way in improving things for the most important reason possible, our students. Again, we are all employees of NIU. I am proud to stand alongside colleagues of all classifications in our efforts to make NIU the best institution it can be. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
morning. Holly Nicholson, Operating Staff Council President. First, Chair Coleman, I'm sorry to hear that you're not going to be coming on for another six-year term. I have an incredible amount of respect for you, and I truly appreciate your leadership. And there's probably more I should say, but I don't think you really enjoy that, so I might just send it to you in email offline. So my comments relate very much to Kathy's as well. I want to say I truly feel for everyone who is facing a sudden transition to another unfamiliar employee classification. As someone who has transitioned from operating staff to SPS and then back to operating staff, I know there's a lot to process and to consider. And I first want to provide the assurance that it's not automatically a negative thing to shift to civil service, although I acknowledge the sacrifice that many are having to make with regard to their seniority and also the hiring processes. I'm happy to talk to anyone about my experiences in the two classifications. If that would help at all, please feel free to contact me. But I also want to address some inaccuracies that are circulating regarding operating staff in some of these conversations. Operating staff at large is a very diverse group of people, both in job duties and education. Some do difficult manual labor, but many work in offices in both academic and non-academic areas. There are actually many supervisors who are operating staff. For example, the IT classification has positions all the way up to director. Some of us are salaried, and some aren't, and that depends on how our job duties align with the Fair Labor Standards Act guidelines set at the federal level. And finally, there are many members of operating staff who do hold advanced degrees. To that end, I want to talk more about Kathy's point regarding the unspoken hierarchy that exists between employee classifications. To be clear, again, this isn't unique to NIU. However, I would really love to see our campus be an agent of change in this area. We may have different job duties, pay scales, degrees, roles, etc., but we have very fundamental things in common. We are all Huskies. Employees in every classification display professionalism, strong work ethic, and specialized skills. We care about the mission of NIU, and most of all, we care deeply about the success of our students. We all bring our incredibly diverse experiences together to create the best environment possible for our students. And yes, I realize that's always a work in progress. And it may surprise you, but there are actually building service workers who have as much impact on our students' lives as the faculty that teach them in their classrooms. And that's just one example, not to mention the office support staff, advisors, other academic support positions, IT staff, physical plant staff, the list goes on and on. I firmly believe that nobody should be looked down on because of their job title. What is important is their work ethic and their dedication. I understand the hard work people put into their advanced degree programs, and they do deserve a lot of respect. However, while that aids them in being more effective at their jobs, whether that's to teach students or to market NIU's brand, it doesn't make them fundamentally better than anyone else or their voice more valuable. I also have so much respect for the people here who do the difficult, grueling, sometimes dirty jobs that the rest of us don't want to do. I applaud them, and I'm grateful for them, just as much as I'm grateful for our talented advising staff, our dedicated office staff, and our amazing faculty. And I'm guessing what I'm saying is not new to most people in this room. However, if any of this does speak to you, I ask that you take it to heart and do what you can to make NIU a more equitable, inclusive place for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Holly, for your comments as well. I'm assuming that's it with the comments, or can the, you know, all right. At this point in time, I have to tell you, last week was a really, really exciting week. We had an opportunity to go to Detroit, Michigan, our NIU Husky football team competed against the University of Buffalo, and we scored 20 points in the second half, ended up winning the game by 1 point. Awesome victory, the fifth MAC championship in how many years?
It's our fourth in the last seven, I think.
The fourth MAC championship in the last
seven or eight
years. That's what I call building a legacy of champions. and we can do it on the football field, and we definitely are doing it in the classroom. So one thing we requested, and I don't know if we have any of the football players or any of the representatives from the football team or the athletic department here today. Matt, would you like to speak to?
Yeah, Chair Coleman, first of all, A.D. Frazier and Coach Carey both apologize for not being able to be here. They're both traveling. We were going to have some members of our football team come to present the trophy. We told them it's finals, the week before finals, go to class. We do have two of our prominent football players, though, who are on their way to Orlando. Max Sharping actually just was in New York and was recognized as one of the 13 finalists for the National Football Foundation Award, which is an incredible recognition. The winner of that gets what's called the Academic Heisman, so to have Max in that category is really, really exciting. And then just yesterday we found out that Sutton Smith was named All-American, so there's a lot of exciting stuff going on. We wanted to make sure we had the trophy here for you all to celebrate. But again, Coach Carey extends his condolences for not being able to be here this morning.
That's excellent. And so, Trustee Wasowicz, you were at the football game. Any comments you'd like to make other than talking about the big hug you received after the victory?
I don't know. I was just blown away. In fact, you know what? It was kind of an interesting thing. And you see the game, you see what's going on. And I looked at the Buffalo fans afterwards, and I said, you know, I remember we were in that situation once before, too. It looked like we were going to win the game, and then in the last play, we lost in the MAC championship. And Lisa and I and Wheeler were coming up the elevator to the hotel after the cigar bar. And we were on the and this is really an interesting story, I think, because we were on the elevator, and there was a coach from Buffalo. And he's the receivers coach, and he looked like he just lost his best friend, and I felt, you know, badly for him. I was happy that we won, but the interesting thing was that his wife was with him and his kids, and his wife was an NIU alum, and his wife is, I believe her maiden name is Denise Dove. She was she is in our Hall of Fame women's basketball player. So she's not just an alum. She's a really big, you know, athletic alum here as well. And I just thought, wow, what a small world, you know, for that to happen. And I think for her it was a little bittersweet because she, you know, she was sad for her husband, but yet we won. And just what a great victory, that's for sure. It was seeing all of our teammates and fans and everybody on there, it was just incredible. So congratulations. Go Huskies. Let's do it again.
Chair Coleman, I'd just be remiss if I didn't put my old faculty athletics rep hat on for just a second and say not only are we proud that we win MAC championships, but our football program has consistently been at the top of the graduation rate in the Mid-American Conference, and that's something, frankly, as a faculty member, I'm far more proud of than MAC championships, although I certainly love MAC championships as well.
We love them both, right? congratulations to the football team. Anybody else want to make any comments on that? No. All right. Then let's go ahead. Let's move on to agenda item number 6, our reports of the board committees and board liaison. Trustee Butler, first of all, the reports of the board committee and the board liaison can be found under agenda item 6. Do any trustees have any questions? And I know before we open up the floor for questions, Trustee Butler, you would like to make some comments.
I just want to put on the record that the Merit Board met after this report was printed. They met on November 29th, 2018, and nothing really important happened there. I'm just kidding. Several major things happened that bear on our ongoing discussion today, the remarks that have already been made, and remarks that I would like to save my comments on for later when we receive the presentation from HR. But I will just put on the record that of note, there was a sort of final look at a furlough policy that has been making its way through the policy rulemaking change. It's too late to do much about that now because it's pretty much done. I'll talk about that later. There's also a proposal on changes to the discharge and demotion rules I had some comments at the meeting on that. I won't be talking about that today, but that's early in the stages, and there may be some time to have some impact on that. There was a discussion on rule changes regarding the transfer of police officers and examinations. The chief, who's sitting here, may want to talk with me about some of those changes. That's early in the stage now as well. There was general discussion about the issue you've heard so much about already, which we'll talk about later. There were two audits shared with the Merit Board, which I'm going to briefly talk about later, as well as they, I think, support a point that I want to make later. And then of significant note, too, the executive director presented in his report a very early draft of a potential new policy that would produce or create a probation period of 24 months for civil service employees hired as part of a grant-funded project. It was called grant-funded, not grant and contract-funded. But I took a position against that at this stage, arguing that there were better approaches than to create a different kind of civil service employee under different sets of rules. But that's in a very, very early stage. And then finally, the executive director was reviewed by the Merit Board, and there was a move to increase his salary by 3%, which was supported by the board.
Thank you, John. At this point, we'll go to agenda item. Are there other questions? Or
if I might just make a comment on the Finance Committee, there was a discussion. You had had a question with respect to the university's debt levels with respect to our peers. And I've prepared this report in the past, maybe a year and a half or so ago, but I distributed a report that shares our financial situation with respect in a comparison with our other eight public universities that you have. And I just think it's important for context, as I try to talk about generally, but there's a comparison of a four-year kind of run rate with all the publics. And then there's measurements of net working capital, leverage, revenue to debt, three-year cumulative kind of gain or loss of our operating statement, and then days working capital. And simply for context, I would mention that in days working capital of the nine universities, we rank eighth. In the leverage ratio, we rank ninth. In the revenue to debt ratio, we rank ninth. In the cumulative gap, we rank eighth. And the days working capital ranked ninth. I just simply want to share that for context. You had the question. I think it's important relative to our peers to mention, and you folks have the data. We'll talk more about it in subsequent meetings.
Yeah, and Trustee, we know that the state budget had a tremendous impact on all of our institutions. We know it had an impact on NIU. We were able to get through 700 days without a budget, without announcing massive layoffs and all the similar. And we avoided. And in fact, last night I was with the president of Chicago State, and she talked about the 700 days and the impact that it had on their institution, the 700 days without a budget. They didn't have the reserves like we had to dip into. They had to let quite a few folks go. In fact, half of just about every category of staff were released from that institution. Thank goodness we're not in that position. In spite of some of the heavy debt that we're carrying. The great thing is that we've got a new administration that's coming into office. There is a renewed commitment to feed higher education. And so we have to continue to tighten our belt. Yep. We've got to continue to pay down our debt. And hopefully we can find a way to climb up that financial ladder.
No doubt.
Right. Yep. And I trust with our CFO being on board and helping us mature our capabilities, helping us get more visibility into our finances and your staff, along with the leadership here and the leadership within the Board of Trustees, that we're going to move this thing in the right direction. Yeah.
Simply want to just be informed. And this surely is not a 2017 or 2018 phenomenon. This is the foundation that was, you know, over a long period of time. But I think it's important to just understand what the facts are relative to the peers.
Saying 8 out of 9 and 9, I mean, 8, it says 9 schools, so correct. We're 8 or 9 out of 9.
Correct.
So we're in last place in a lot of, okay.
I would just like to add that our external accreditor, the Higher Learning Commission, just notified us yesterday that concerns they had expressed during the 700 days without a budget about our cash flow have been completely addressed, and they commended us for the proactive steps we had taken since that time to restore our fiscal sustainability.
Absolutely.
Yep. All right. If there's no other comments, we'll go to agenda item number 7, the President Report number 129. The following items have been moved to consent agenda. Agenda item 7B1, Professional Excellence Awards for faculty and staff. Agenda item 7B2, Annual Financial Summary as of June 30th, 2018, and budget to gap reconciliation. Agenda item 7B3, first quarter fiscal year 2019 financial summary as of September the 30th, 2018. Agenda item 7B4, quarterly summary report of transaction in excess of $100,000 for the period July 1st, 2018 through September 30th, 2018. Agenda item 7B5, periodic report on investment period ending September 30th, 2018. Agenda item 7B6, fiscal year 2018, annual report of transactions involving real property. Agenda item 7B7, fiscal year 2018, report on facilities and infrastructure capital investment activities. Agenda item 7B8, state legislative update. Agenda item 7B9, federal regulation. A federal relations report. Agenda item 7B10, sponsored program administration, and agenda item 7B11, intellectual property procedures and portfolio. May I have a motion to move all these items through the consent agenda?
So moved.
Got a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Is there any discussions? Hearing none. May I take a vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The motion is approved. At this time, I ask Dr. Lisa Freeman to present the university recommendations forward by the board committees.
Thank you, Chair Coleman. The first of the university's recommendation is agenda item 7A1, fiscal year 2020 undergraduate tuition pricing recommendation. The item presents the pricing recommendations that address NIU's tuition rates for fiscal year 20. The recommendations hold base tuition flat in fiscal year 20 for the fourth year in a row, while making modest adjustments both up and down to differential tuition rates. The Finance Audit Compliance Facilities and Operations Committee recommended the Board of Trustees approve the fiscal year 2020 undergraduate tuition pricing recommendation, and I'm hereby forwarding that to you by way of the President's report.
We had a lot of debate on this item. At this point in time, may I have a motion to approve?
No.
Got a second?
Second.
Or any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion is approved.
Agenda item 7A2 is the fiscal year 2020 general fee pricing recommendation. The item presents a pricing recommendation that addresses NIU's general fees for fiscal year 20. These recommendations include a reduction to the total fees paid by students by reducing the health and wellness charge through our agreement with Northwestern Medicine Healthcare. The total of all other fees in fiscal year 20 remains constant, while making very modest adjustments to the distribution of fees. The recommendation coming forward from the FACFO committee to the Board of Trustees is for approval of the fiscal year 2020 general fee pricing recommendation.
May I have a motion to approve the general fee pricing recommendation?
So moved.
Get a second?
Second.
Get a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion is approved.
Agenda item 7A3, fiscal year 2020 graduate and law tuition pricing recommendation. The item presents the pricing recommendation that addresses NIU's tuition rates for fiscal year 2020 for graduate and law tuition. The recommendations hold base tuition flat in fiscal year 20 for the fourth year in a row while making modest adjustments both up and down to differential tuition rates. The recommendation coming forward from the FACFO committee is an endorsement of the amended fiscal year 2020 graduate and law tuition pricing recommendation with the addition of the graduate certificate and public management online program differential included in this item and recommended to the Board of Trustees for approval.
May I have a motion for the 2020 graduate and law tuition pricing recommendation?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion is approved.
Agenda item 7A4, fiscal year 2020 room and board fee recommendation. This item presents a pricing recommendation that addresses NIU's room and board fees for fiscal year 20. Note that the rates for New Hall and Northern View, the Collegiate Housing Foundation 2 project, are considered separately and not included in this recommendation. They appear in the item for informational purposes only. The university is recommending that room and board rates considered in this item remain constant to the fiscal year 19 rates, and the FACFO committee recommends Board of Trustees approval for this recommendation.
May I have a motion for the fiscal year 2020 room and board fee recommendation?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion?
Can I ask a quick question, Wheeler?
Mm-hmm.
Did I see Dan in the room, or is he gone from food service or from hospital? Okay. So, maybe John could help me here. So, the move with the Holmes reconstruction, we were moving a lot of the food service that Holmes would have supplied to Neptune and did a refurb on the Neptune food services. How did all that work this semester? Did we accomplish our mission of making it transparent for the students that they didn't have access to Holmes as they had before? Or did we have issues?
I'll do my best to speak on behalf of Dan Keenan on this issue, but I believe so. We invested in Neptune to specifically bring that dining atmosphere and environment up to better standards. So knowing that we were going to bring Holmes down and not have all the food establishments there, we were going to rely more heavily on Neptune dining to be that central campus midday dining experience for most of the population, and I think we were able to accomplish that. Does that address your question?
Dan Keenan actually reports to Vice President Wessner Michael. Kelly, would you like to add anything since dining falls in your purview?
I would just like to add one of the things that I think is truly enhanced at campus as part of this initiative is not only did we upgrade Neptune, but we also added coffee and bagels in the library, which has been a great enhancement for our campus community, lots more traffic in the library, and a really great space for our students. We also did upgrades in DuSable so students can rent a class, grab something, have better options over there, and enhance our academic buildings as well. So we've had opportunities not to only impact our residential dining, but also some of our academic facilities as well in this process. And we feel like our students feel good about this, and we're really excited about the road ahead.
Great. Good. Thank you.
Any other questions on this matter? If not, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion is approved.
Agenda item 7A5, launch of Jobs for America's Graduates, or JAG, programs in Illinois. The Ed Systems Center has been contracted by the Illinois Department of Employment Security to launch a new initiative, a Job for America's Graduates program in Illinois. These programs already operate in 34 states, including Iowa, and the project in Illinois will be modeled after the Iowa program. Iowa JAG will assist and advise Ed Systems. In this agreement, Iowa JAG is named. IDES will pay NIU $800,000 over fiscal year 2020, 2,110 in fiscal 19, 590,000, 210,000 in fiscal year 19, 590,000 in fiscal year 20. The Iowa subcontract is a total of $667,500, with NIU retaining $132,500. The Finance Audit Compliance Facilities and Operations Committee recommends Board of Trustees approval of the launch of Jobs for America's Graduates programs in Illinois. This is essentially an authorization to accept external funding.
Great. Can I get a motion to approve the recommendation? Second?
Second.
We got a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion is approved.
Agenda item 7A6, College of Health and Human Sciences Cameras and Recording Systems. The College of Health and Human Sciences is requesting funding in support of new cameras and recording system to assist their clinical teaching mission. The funding source is institutional local funds. The amount of $260,000 requires Board of Trustees approval. The Finance Audit Compliance Facilities and Operations Committee recommends approval of the College of Health and Human Sciences Cameras Recording Systems request.
May I have a motion to approve the recommendation?
So moved.
Can I have a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Is there any discussion?
Just for clarity, I would ask that, or for affirmation, that this is essential for students to have as a practitioner room, that these funds are critical for our teaching role. Is that correct?
It absolutely is, but Dean Block is here and she can confirm that. These are clinical programs where that interaction is a critical part of the training. Documentation of it is important for making sure that students are prepared to be practitioners and to meet the accreditation examiner's request, but I'll let Dean Block speak in more detail to that.
Hello, Daryl Block, Dean of the College of Health and Human Sciences. Yes, it's critical for their teaching learning, and it's also, in many cases, critical to get reimbursement from insurance companies in our clinics. For some disciplines, it is necessary to get reimbursement that there be direct, if a graduate student is working with a patient, that there be direct line of sight in another room through camera from a licensed practitioner, and that's the only way that we can get the insurance reimbursement for the visit. So, yes, it's important.
Thank you, Trustee. Any other questions? No? Any other questions? No? At this point, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody oppose? Motion passes.
Agenda item 7A7, steam isolation valve and expansion joint replacement. The IBHE had a mid-year inquiry on critical urgent repair requirements, and this project, fortunately for us, was identified as submitted for possible appropriated funding. In September of 2018, funds were released by the Governor's Office of Management and Budget to the Capital Development Board to execute this project. It will be accomplished by NIU contractors and reimbursed by the Capital Development Board. The appropriated funds held by the Capital Development Board total $476,000. NIU local funding for coordination is expected to be less than $25,000. $25,000 is proposed for approval. The Finance Audit Compliance Facilities and Operations Committee recommends Board of Trustees approval of the steam isolation valve and expansion joint replacement.
May I have a motion to approve the steam isolation valve and expansion joint replacement? Are these body parts? Or?
I just want you to know, I asked if we could have steam valve here as an example, and John said that would be a little awkward.
May I have a motion to approve the recommendation?
So moved.
We have a second.
Second.
A motion and a second. Any discussions? No?
Yeah, all those. Glad we're taking care of this.
Pardon me?
Just so glad we're taking care of this.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion approved.
Agenda item 7A8, Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability. As you may remember, the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability is a hub of the Illinois Innovation Network and a new initiative leveraging NIU's expertise and resources to pursue basic and applied research, education, training, and economic development. The item has been forwarded from the RILA committee with a request to approve the center, NICS, with the requirement that approval of all expenditures will be requested at future board meetings. And in fact, we'll see an item later today. Just to give you an update, the first organizational meeting of the Illinois Innovation Network occurred on November 28th. All state universities were present or invited. The first Discovery Partners Institute retreat will be held on December 10th to focus on the four themes and four crosscuts. And NIU is the only non-U of I institution invited because of our status of having the first non-University of Illinois site in the Illinois Innovation Network. Authority is requested to proceed with this grant opportunity. Approval for execution of the required design, construction, and related expenditures to establish the hub will be requested separately. Just as a matter of point, the DCO grant funding from the University of Illinois will flow in at $15 million, and NIU local funding will be at $5 million. The Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee recommends Board of Trustees approval of the Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability. And again, we'll see a separate item later.
May I have a motion to approve the recommendation?
So moved.
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Is there any discussion?
You know, this was great. Governor was out here. We did the whole Tim Kaline was here and everything else. Of the $5 million, what are the plans right now as far as, you know, how we're going to get that?
So as you may remember, we had a match of about $7.9 million. $2.9 was in-kind related to the preparations that had been done to the site and other amenities. The $5 million is $1 million a year in equipment. This is money that we put in our budget every year, looking at capital renewal for research equipment. Part of it may be funded through agreements like the one that you've approved previously with Shimadzu in a partnership agreement. So we're confident that that's a target we can make, and it has synergy with other commitments we generally make as part of our research budget. But I'd be happy to ask Dr. Blasey if he wants to comment further on that.
I mean, I love this idea. I love what we're doing. I just want to make sure that, and it's not a $5 million lump sum. It's $1 million a year over 5 years. Okay.
We couldn't spend $5 million given our procurement processes in 1 year, even if we wanted, let's face it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Good point.
could you talk a little bit about just to take one step up from the center on our local campus to talk about the program as a whole? Because we're one of several centers that are around the state in cooperation with the University of Illinois. And can you just talk to the board a little bit about the program as a whole?
Absolutely. So there is the Illinois Innovation Network, which intends to place hubs around the state. The hubs will have distinct purposes and themes that align with the overall themes that have been proposed to the state by the University of Illinois. So, for example, food and agriculture is one of them, and you would see that our center with water stewardship and food innovation systems and environmental change would have some resonance there. But, for example, UIC is a hub of the Illinois Innovation Network, and drug development, small molecule pharmaceuticals is an emphasis there. There will be additional hubs. Springfield has one that's focused more on small business innovation. The focus at Urbana-Champaign is data analytics. There will be one coming forward in Peoria that has a healthcare emphasis. And the idea is that if you're in the innovation network, you can work with any of the hubs. The central hub will be in Chicago. It will be the Discovery Partners Institute. New construction is expected to build a large facility there, but they already have temporary space on Wacker Drive where they're starting to affect this vision of bringing in faculty, students, postdoctoral fellows from around the state and ultimately around the world to work together on ideation, on technology development, on taking these themes and the talents and visions of faculty and staff from around the state, as well as private sector industry, bringing them together to try to move things in a way that will help economic development in the state of Illinois. And one of the points I want to make when we talk about the four crosscuts and the four themes, we're not just talking about hard science or technology. It's very clear to everyone involved that you need humanists and social scientists involved up front. For example, you don't want to create a food production efficiency that will be unpalatable or unattractive to consumers. So there'll be, you know, human-computer interface and all kinds of things really coming together. I mentioned that this would be international. There are already two Israeli universities that have agreed to be part of DPI. There'll be a press conference for one of them, I think Hebrew University, next week, and another one the first week of January. And those are probably only the first two international partners that will be part of this overall vision. You know, NIU and the University of Illinois were the two universities that were identified by the Brookings Institution report as leaders in both research and the social mobility of students. So NIU and the UI system have that in common. We were already working with a college on the Urbana campus and talking to the U of I system about collaboration. And that is why NIU is able to be the first non-U of I hub in the innovation system. Now other state universities are looking at the process for being recognized as hubs, and it's a competitive process that's ongoing.
You just answered my next question, so great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's pretty awesome.
It is.
It's awesome. Any other items? No discussion. At this point in time, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion is approved. We will now move to items directly from the President. President Freeman, will you please present your next three items?
Agenda item 7C1 is the long-awaited presentation on supportive professional staff and civil service. We have with us Senior Associate Vice President of Human Resource Services, Laura Alexander, and Celeste Latham, the Associate Vice President of Administration for Human Resource Services. And they're going to give us a presentation on how university personnel are employed in accordance with the rules of the State University Civil Service System. Trustee Butler, did you want to introduce this?
Sure. I just want to say that they're obviously the HR administrators who are here with us today are going to explain the policy and their efforts to implement the policy. I would like, after they're finished, to offer some observations that are more policy reform oriented that may then help you distinguish between whether your question might go to me or go to them, if that's all right with you.
So, you want me to go first?
Yes, okay. Please.
Long awaited, huh, Lisa? Celeste, do you want to have a seat in front just so we can, in case we have questions? Thanks for inviting us this morning, everyone. I'm Laura Alexander. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer at NIU. And as Lisa, President Freeman indicated, Celeste is also with me, and she is the head of HR operations within the Office of Human Resources. We only have 10 slides today, so it's definitely not a deep dive into this topic. It's more of a high-level overview, but we certainly want to make sure we have enough time to answer any and all of your questions that you may have. So feel free to interject any questions at any point during the 10 slides as we run through them. I do invite Trustee Butler and President Freeman to add any comments that they feel appropriate, as they both have knowledge and experience on this topic of these two employment categories. So, the first slide. These are some general provisions of the Civil Service Statute. First off, by definition, all positions excluding graduate assistants fall under the State University Civil Service System, and I'm going to use the acronym SUCS, as awful as it sounds. Everyone's kind of familiar with that. The second bullet indicates that the determination of the appropriate job classification is based simply on the job description and the duties. That's all, just that job description. And the third important bullet here is that positions can only be removed from civil service classification if the duties outlined in the job description do not fit a civil service classification. So it's as simple as that. If the job description primarily matches a civil service classification, then it's civil service. If it doesn't, it's SPS. Point of information is that we are audited by the civil service system every couple of years. They come along and do random testing of our determinations of classification and make sure that we're following the statute. Any questions on that? Okay, so what does it take to be exempted from a civil service classification? There are five different areas of exemption. The first one is all of you, the Board of Trustees, are exempted by statute, as well as the Merit Board, of which Trustee Butler is a member. The presidents and the vice presidents are by definition exempted. And the third category tends to be the squishiest one, where there's more gray area. And that's called the principal administrative exemption. And that includes licensed professionals such as doctors, lawyers, dentists, attorneys, as well as people at the associate or assistant vice president level, vice provost, et cetera. Fourth category of exemption is people that do teaching and research and extension faculties of each institution. And then the fifth exemption is, of course, students. This table is just intended to give you an overview of the differences in these job categories. Now, the civil service category is, as Holly Nicholson alluded to earlier, is split into both hourly paid employees and salary paid employees. So we've got two categories of civil service here. One category of SPS, because all SPS are salaried employees. You will note that the vacation time varies depending on whether a position is hourly or salaried. The sick days are the same for all three categories. The layoff notice requirements, we wanted to make sure there's an understanding of the distinction between a layoff and a termination. A layoff implies that an employee could be reinstated or brought back to the job. And a termination is more of a permanent determination. Within the civil service statute, I believe Kathy Doderline pointed out there's at least a 30-day notice period for a layoff. Some collective bargaining agreements have a longer notice period, such as 45 or 60 days. For the SPS category, the termination comes along with a set notice period, and that is based on years of service with the institution. So if I get to the three-year marker, I get a one-year notice period. If I've been here less than 3 years, it's a shorter notice period. And that's university policy. For a termination in the civil service arena, that is driven by the state statute. There are numerous provisions in state statute that offer rights and protections to employees who are in the midst of a termination situation. There is a large amount of due process involved in termination decisions in the civil service world, such as multiple iterations of verbal warnings, written warnings, suspensions without pay. All of those steps of progressive discipline are part of the civil service statute. We did note the employee headcount for you, so you could see the number of folks in each of these categories. Questions on this slide? Trustee Coleman, yes.
Yes, Laura, thank you very much. I've got a couple of questions, really. This is statewide, right? This is not just all right. And then in terms of vacation and sick days, are they carried over from year after year, or is there a cap that's associated with this, or
yes,
a max
yes.
that you yes? Can you
yes,
explain
and Celeste,
some of that?
Would you indicate what those are, real quick?
So the cap for civil service tends to be 2 years of what they can accrue. With the maximum of 56 accruals. That also applies to the regular SPS. That's the cap on vacation.
Is that both for vacation and sick day?
Sick is indefinite because when they leave the institution, the sick time is reported to the retirement system for credit. They can get service credit towards the retirement up to a year.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Could I ask a follow-on question to that?
Yes, Trustee Barsima.
Given the fact that we're an academic institution and the majority of our students aren't here during the summer, are there any requirements on when civil service employees are asked or required to take vacation, or they could take it at any point in time during the year?
Yes, they must prearrange it with their supervisor, but any time, yes. Okay, I'll move on. I had a question, too, on the...
So the termination notice requirements, I reflect back to when I went through my orientation when I first got on the board, and I just remember hearing some pretty bad stories of people doing some not-so-good things, but yet they could never be terminated. So, and they would just be moved to a different department. I mean, I don't, again, I'm just a messenger. I heard this, but I'm just repeating what I heard. So,
right.
So... But how does that work? I mean, what do we mean by, you know, the SUCCS statutes and rules? I mean,
Laura, maybe you want to talk about the HR director's letter to the system regarding reinstatement.
Absolutely. I was just thinking the same thing, Dr. Freeman. So within the civil service statute, as you know, there are numerous levels of progressive discipline that the employees are expected to be eligible for. That can take a year or more to go through all of those levels of progressive discipline and allow the employee to succeed under the expectations, and then another iteration takes place. At the end of all of that, if we get to a discharge, defendable discharge position, the employee has the additional protection of appealing to the merit board. And the merit board has the option to reinstate that employee in the position. And we've had that happen at this university and at other universities. So the feeling among the supervisors is that even if I do all this work, I'm still going to be potentially, you know, stuck with this employee if they come back. So the feeling, there is a feeling campus-wide, and it's at all of the 12 campuses, that as a supervisor, my hands are a bit tied in terms of being able to actually transition someone out. So the HR officers across the state have gotten together and written a letter to the merit board to open up the discussion about this provision where the merit board can reinstate employees.
And I'm guessing that if we do have a bad actor, that the supervisor is saying we don't want them here. And I had heard some stories like a brick being thrown through a supervisor's window and
yep.
So we just move them into a different department then?
No.
Is, or what?
Not if we are involved. I have a term for that, but I'm not going to say what it is. No, we really don't want to move a problem across campus. We would deal with it on a disciplinary front. I'm not going to say that hasn't happened in the past. I think it has happened in the past, but since I've been here, I haven't condoned movement of performance problems. Do you have anything else to say about this? Or Dr. Freeman, do you have anything else to add?
Trustee Butler would like to say something.
I think the concern is that the case seems to become an original, brand new matter when it goes before the merit board, and the university ends up sort of defending the entire process from the beginning, and the merit board, in almost like a gut check sort of way, decides, is it reasonable to have terminated this person for that reason? And I think that's what the HR managers are concerned about, is that they've gone through this extensive process. They've applied their professional discipline. They've talked to all the parties involved. They've made a recommendation and a decision that's been appealed. And then it sort of starts over again when it goes to the merit board. Now, the merit board is pursuing currently changes to the particular rules that they follow and the universities have to follow with respect to dismissal and demotion. My own personal view is that those rules are not impacted and have not been affected by the concerns that have been expressed by the HR managers. Not as of now.
I guess I would, since you gave me the opportunity to comment, just make it clear that most of our employees are wonderful. As we've noted earlier, they care deeply about our mission and our students. We have progressive discipline for a reason, and the majority of times when somebody does something and they're made aware that there's a better way to do it, they take the advice and they improve and succeed. We are a large organization, and sometimes we move employees because their skill set is better suited to an area other than the one they may have started in. But by the time something goes to discharge to the Civil Service Board, it's a very rare case. And I just wanted to make that clear on the record.
Right, and supervisors come to us in frustration because, as we all know, anyone that supervises, if you do have one problem person, it takes about 80% of your time sometimes to manage that situation. So that's where the frustration is. Any other questions on this slide? Okay. There's a lot of information on this slide. This lays out the differences in the categories when it comes to recruiting employees, review of job applicants, and the referral and interviewing of job applicants. So under the civil service column in recruitment, it's important to note that the civil service statute requires an external search for every vacancy, period. If you look on the SPS side, there are options. Depending on the situation and weighing in with affirmative action, it could be an internal search only. It could be external. It also, once in a rare occasion, would involve a search waiver. And search waivers can happen for a variety of reasons. The department may request a target of opportunity or diversity hire. The department may have an emergency hiring situation. They may have a researcher that they'd like to hire with unique and specialized skills. Or it may be a spousal accommodation hire, which is more common when it comes to hiring faculty that may or may not have a spouse that's also looking for employment. Review of applicants. Again, this one is a bit confusing, and this is a spot of concern for supervisors. In the civil service column, the minimum qualifications that need to be put into the job advertisement must come from the civil service specification. So it's literally a copy and paste from the civil service classification into the job ad for the minimum quals. And Chelsea or Cindy, would one of you be able to click on that link? Thanks. I wanted to give you an example, and this is an actual civil service job classification, if we can pull it up, for an immigration specialist. So you can see the top area is a list of the duties and responsibilities that would be typical for a position that does this kind of work. And I want to draw your attention down a bit lower under the minimum qualifications. Thank you. So this section here is what would be copied and pasted into the job advertisement. And it talks about in the first line that 1 year of outright experience in certain areas is required. And then it further talks about 3 additional years, which can be substituted by certain forms of formal education. Now, if you're a job applicant looking at that, it's confusing. You know, people are used to seeing qualifications that say bachelor's degree in X or master's degree in X. And then underneath that, it will say X years of experience in, you know, these areas. But when we have to cut and paste these minimum qualifications into the ad from the civil service spec, it doesn't read intuitively, and people are confused. And hiring managers are feeling that the job applicants have a perception that the complexity and the scope of the job may be not that high because we didn't start out with an educational requirement. Thank you. We can go back to the slide. Thanks. Also, in terms of how the statute works, job application qualifications must be reviewed by human resources, and the qualified applicants must pass a civil service exam in order to be deemed qualified. They must have a certain score on that exam. Obviously, on the SPS side, it works like the rest of the world. Qualifications are based on the job description, and the applications' qualifications are reviewed by the hiring manager and or the search committee. And then finally, how applicants get referred to the department for consideration is that by the statute, civil service applicants are referred by human resources, and only applicants with the top three scores on the test will be referred to the department. That's frustrating as well for some of the hiring managers because they want to see everyone that applied, and they may want to consider other people that are qualified that maybe didn't happen to score in the top three. But the statute prevents that. And, of course, in SPS, the applicants are ranked by the search committee for campus interview. So there's a lot here, and I'm thinking maybe you have questions or comments on this. Does everyone understand the limitations and the challenges? Okay. So this is the recruiting part. All right, so now we get to the point where there have been some recent changes in how this all works, and it's led to a heightened awareness and a heightened level of conversation on all of the campuses. About a year ago, the State of Illinois Office of Executive Inspector General, OEIG, investigated one of the other public universities in the state, had some concerns, and as a result, required that the SUCS office update their procedures in terms of how to classify positions. The most important takeaway with these new procedures is the second bullet, which states that universities now must transition both the person and the job within 16 months if a review of the job description for an SPS position determines that the position fits the civil service classification. So previously how it worked was an employee was allowed to stay in the SPS position, even though it may be needing to be converted to civil service, they were allowed to stay in that position until they transitioned naturally out of the position, at which time the position may be converted to civil service. But the new procedures require that that happen within 16 months. That's the most important piece of the new procedures. Questions?
16 months of
time. The identification that the job is misclassified potentially as SPS and should be civil service.
Well, it couldn't possibly, the clock couldn't start before October 1st.
Correct.
So now, are they arguing that all the positions that had already been identified by then, that clock starts on October 1st?
Right.
Okay, so there had been an audit earlier that had identified several misclassified positions. And so the clock started for those positions October 1st. And as I'll point out later, the university presidents, all nine of them, signed a letter asking for a delay in that start date, which didn't get implemented. Well, what I mean is that the Civil Service Merit Board did not respond positively to that request.
So nine university presidents say we hold off, and they say, we know better.
Well, I believe I'm not inaccurate when I say the thought was it was the 11th hour, they should have spoke up sooner. That's not my position.
Okay.
I personally requested that the board meet when the letter was received. I just didn't at the time have enough people behind
me. John, who's on the merit board?
There's three representatives from the University of Illinois system, and then there's one representative from all the other state boards. So it's fair to say that there are members of the board who are sensitive to the letter that was received by both the HR managers and the university presidents. There is the response of the executive director of the merit board is that the implementation must take place as we promised to the OEIG that it would, and a delay would expose us to a continuation of that investigation. And that's not my personal view, and I've expressed my view. I'm not a lone voice, but I'm pretty alone.
And the head of the merit board is somebody comes from one of the universities.
The chair is the merit board representative
from Western
Illinois University.
Okay.
Thanks, Trustee Butler. Let's see. So current civil service procedures that you need to be aware of are obviously the SUCS office does conduct regular audits to determine that we're being compliant with the regulations. And then this is just luck of the draw on the second bullet. Based on the pre-existing audit schedule and timetable, we NIU happen to be the next in line to be audited since the 10-1 procedures went into effect. Within the next couple of months, we'll be the first university that gets audited under these new procedures. U of I has already pretty much said they're watching to see what happens with us before they decide how to move forward. And this is going to what Trustee Butler was just speaking about. The most recent audits found that some of our SPS positions may need to be converted to civil service because of changes in the classification or modifications to the classification at the SUCS level, or because possibly the position was misclassified years ago. So we have about 75 positions currently that are being reviewed and may need to be converted with that 16-month timeline in mind. We used to have 80, we're down to 75, so that's good. Okay.
Is that 75 out of the 692 SPS employees?
Yes.
Okay. So roughly 10%, thereabouts.
I guess I also want to add here that an opinion that I have shared with HRS, with the other presidents and chancellors, with the leadership of the State University Civil Service System, is one that aligns with, a proverb my mother used to say, you measure twice and you cut once. I like to avoid compliance audit findings, but not at the expense of doing irrevocable damage to our employees. So we have a process in place to review those 75 positions and make decisions, and we will be moving there. And I commend our HR people for being on top of this early compared to some of their colleagues in the state. But we are not going to rush through so that we can check 75 boxes without being thoughtful about not only the impact on the institutions, but the impact on the individuals in those positions.
Can I ask a follow-on question to that, Lisa? Who makes, once the audit's been done on the 75 positions, who makes the final decision on if they're going to be moved to civil service? Is that in your vein to make that decision, or is that done by a separate body at the state level? Or is it unknown?
Well, I mean, when the audit determines a position is improperly classified, we have an obligation to review it. And in some cases, we agree with that finding. In others, we believe that there may be something that's worthy of further conversation, appeal. Sometimes we review something and we find that
The answer isn't either what we started with or what the audit suggests, but that there's more complexity and an opportunity to look at things even a different way. Laura, maybe you want to add something here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we have an interactive process with the hiring managers when they have a job that needs to be reviewed. We'll do the classification within HR because statutorily that's what's expected. If the department is unhappy with that or doesn't feel it's an accurate reflection of what the job is, we will help them. We will look at their whole organizational structure and help them move possible responsibilities around between positions or do reorganizations or whatever they might wish to do to change the outcome of the classification or just change their organizational structure if they like. But they can have multiple interactions with us to have that move the needle.
So you can see these are complex transactions. Mm-hmm. It's not that you can look at a list of 75 and at the end of the day, have 74 of them done.
Yeah,
right.
I understand it. But just from a process standpoint, once we go through our audit or review of these positions and come to whatever conclusions we come to, before that conclusion is given to the department, who these positions reside in, does the audit people from the state come and review our findings and bless them, and then we go forward? Because what I would think we would want to avoid is going back to a department and going, here are our results, and of the 75, I'm just going to throw out a number, of the 75, we were going to move 60, to civil service, and then the auditors come in and they go, no, we don't agree with that. You're moving all of them over, and now we've got...
The landscape is a little different because, as Laura said, in the past, we would get audit findings and we would review the positions. And in many cases, we would flag them for conversion upon the departure of the incumbent. And then at that point in time, it could be the next week or it could be in a couple of years. If it was the next week, we would convert it. If it was in a couple of years, we would look at the current context and the updates. But we previously have not converted positions with people incumbent in them on a large scale basis. I mean, it's not that it was never done, but it wasn't done in this way. And so as we look at these now, it's very complicated. And the decisions we make have a lot of impact. So, as you're trying to figure out the issue of seniority came up, these are been professional job applications that you could probably, in many cases, look at one classification in the civil service system or another. And what are the implications and ramifications of doing that for the individual, for the department, for the university in terms of fairness and consistency? And so as you consider these things, it takes a long time. It takes some back and forth because the person who really knows what they've been doing is the person in the job and their supervisor. And so that's why we're obeying the law. We're doing everything possible to comply with the audit, but we're being thoughtful about it because doing it wrong will have higher costs than doing it more slowly than the Civil Service Commission and auditors might wish.
Right. And just to second that, what the auditors look for when they come in is not that we made a determination on every one of the flagged positions, but that we're doing due diligence. Excuse me, we're working with the department to get the updated job documentation. That's in process. Things are in play. They're looking for us to be moving in motion, not necessarily we've finished it. And then I think you were asking a little bit about who makes the call in terms of a classification outcome. That would be HR. But the civil service system will remind you that by the grace of God, they have given us the exemption authority, as they call it, but that they could also take that back. And, we've heard that talked about before where the systems office has said, well, if things get too outrageous, we're going to pull back. We're going to pull back that authority to exempt positions, and the universities will no longer be able to do that.
And are we first to go through the audit just because of timing?
Yes. It's coincidence. Yes.
Lucky us.
I know.
All of our sister institutions are really pleased that we are the next.
Taking it for the team.
It's an unhappy coincidence. I want to interject two things. One is the The systems office is pretty busy right now. I'm showing you, these are all the new positions that are being created. Quite a few, which, you know, that may bear on some of the efforts that we're making here to render a determination as to whether it should be exempt. And also, I should just point out that there's a good degree of moral imperative in the language being used by the system office as to what it means to not properly classify. And so I'll just read directly from the director's report. He writes, just listen to the language here. If an ongoing position was previously designated as PAA, that's our supported professional staff, fails to perform duties that qualify it for exemption, and the corresponding denial of employment rights granted by the Illinois legislature, the position must be converted to civil service. So that gives you a sense of the severity of the mandate.
And who wrote that?
That's the director of the Civil Service Commission.
And where does he or she come from, or what's, is that a divine right thing, or?
It's, do you remember the Lily Tomlin phone company skit?
Yes, I do. Okay.
But it is statutory authority.
Yes.
So a broad question. So the we're covered by the State University Civil Service Statute and rules. Is that just for, is this, are there other components of this that are statewide, or is this just higher education for the state of Illinois system?
It's the four-year public universities. It's not higher education. I want to be clear. The community colleges as units of local government are not affected by this.
So, and it was created when? Back when?
Before I was born.
Yeah.
1952.
I can only look at Bob Pritchard.
Yeah, I keep looking at Bob, too.
Bob did it.
Can you do something, Bob?
Bob wasn't born that much before me. I just want to get that out there.
I want to remind everybody that our HR representatives are responsible for implementing the policy as it is. Yeah, and I'm hoping that my comments afterwards will give us a little bit more to engage with respect to the policy matters as to whether we think this is good or bad and what we're going to do about it.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so kind of a summary. All SPS positions, their duties are currently aligned with a civil service classification, will require review by HR. And so the question might arise as to why an SPS position is currently identified as being misclassified. There could be a couple of different reasons. There possibly were changes in the civil service classification relative to the position, or new civil service classifications created, which now encroach on this job description. Could be that changes in duties were assigned to the position, or general ambiguity, and that means that job classification is a trained profession, but sometimes it's more of an art than a true science, in that we're making a professional judgment in HR, and that might not be the same professional judgment that the system office would make as to where a job should be classified. So that's another reason. Questions on any of that? Okay, so what is the impact of these conversions? It does result in an employee being assigned seniority, as Catherine Dorderline indicated, within the civil service system. And much of the state statute around this job category is based on seniority. And seniority provisions are determined by the state statute. It does not have any impact on retirement or health benefits or pay.
So could you amplify what the state statutes are in terms of that seniority requirement?
The statute is based on seniority, and the whole premise of the statute is seniority. So,
seniority in a position, seniority in a department,
in a job classification. So, if somebody is an accountant one, how long they've been in that job classification is their seniority in that classification. If they worked in a previous classification, they could also have seniority in that classification. So they could have, they could be on multiple registers, as the statute calls it, where they have seniority in multiple classifications, and that is measured against other employees' seniority in the event of a layoff, for example.
So is that additive?
No. No, it's, do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah.
So an employee, whichever classification they served in, they maintain their seniority forever until they resign from the university. So if an employee has served in, let's say, using Laura's example, an accountant two, they're earning seniority in accountant two position, but they're also are in the classification, and they're also earning seniority in the next lower classification. Because if we have to do a layoff scenario and there's no vacant positions or they're the least senior in the current class, they can bump down into the next class. But then if we no longer use the classification that they're sitting in, we have to look at the last classification that they served in because they maintain their seniority forever in that class, unless the class is deleted or they leave.
But if they're moving from SPS into the civil service classification, mm-hmm.
then we need to look
that erases all of the tenure that they've mm-hmm. had.
Correct, right. And based on the guidance we've received so far from the systems office, we have to look at how long can HR verify based on job descriptions in-house and conversations with the department. Have they been doing like work? Meaning, if we would have looked at this 10 years ago and the current classification that we're looking at would have been available 10 years ago, would we have placed the employee in that classification? If so, then we can give them 10 years worth of seniority. So when we do the seniority piece for the conversion, we're looking at how long can we verify they were doing that type of work for that classification so that they're not coming in at the low end of the seniority. We're trying to place them within that schema. The challenge becomes if their job has changed over the 10 years. So maybe in the beginning they looked like a program coordinator and now they look like a program director. We can only give them credit as the program director. We can't give them credit for every classification we would have seen over their tenure. Does that make sense? It's very complex.
Yeah.
Quick question. How do we track all this?
We do a lot of it for seniority pieces. We yes. track all of that through PeopleSoft.
So,
for the conversion piece, it is going through personnel files, having discussions with the supervisor, looking at all the documentation that we have on file in HR evaluations. Sometimes we'll get an insight. It's a case-by-case basis.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Celeste.
Any other questions on this slide? All right, so the summary of some of the steps that have been taken, and this is more on a communications front. HRS has attended SPS Council meetings and Operating Staff Council meetings to respond to questions and engage in conversations about these new procedures. HR does regularly attend both of those council meetings. We've worked in collaboration with SPS Council and some other folks to develop a communication strategy to notify all SPS employees about these procedure changes. Staff whose positions were flagged by the auditors previously have been notified individually along with their supervisor. And position descriptions are being updated, reviewed by HR, and outcomes are being discussed with the supervisor before any final determinations are made. And then communications with the affected employees are ongoing and continual. So those are the broad strokes of what we've been doing to communicate this. And then we just have our contact information. The three of us are responsible for this particular issue. And feel free to contact any or all of us with questions.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
It seems to me that the SPS,
is this on? Yes. That the SPS employees who have been, where their job descriptions have been identified as one to potentially be converted, one, do the individuals know at this point? Or I guess that's my first question. Do they know?
Yes, the ones that were identified in previous audits, the 75 positions,
yes,
they have individually been notified that we need to review their job description and we need to work with them on their job description.
And I don't know, but I'm going to guess that they're in general not happy because of the seniority
yeah.
piece, or how are they reacting to the news?
That's a really good question, Trustee Herrera. It's a mix, but Kathy, absolutely. It's a mix in terms of what we hear. Some employees are looking for the protections of the civil service system and see that as an advantage, and other employees may, you know, depending on what jobs they've been in over time and how much seniority they would come in with, may not be if they don't have a lot of seniority coming in. But Kathy, feel free to respond to that.
Yeah, I definitely
would say that the greatest concern and the greatest anxieties come with that determination of seniority and how that's being reviewed. And I definitely think that the greatest concern seems to come for folks who don't necessarily have a previous job that they've held that aligns appropriately with the laddering system of civil service. And that's where you get instances of people potentially having been here for 10, 15, 20 years, but only being given about 5 years of service is just a generic example, not a specific one. And that's definitely creating a lot of stress. I think on the whole, people see as long as they can have their seniority upheld as much as possible and have access to things like shared governance, which is a whole other conversation and topic, I think they're okay with that shift. But I really think that seniority is a big concern. And then I think the other side of it is concern for how their department will do hiring in the future for that position after they leave. People are very mindful of the fact that it is so much harder to hire civil service positions and attract diverse candidates that, not always the case, but sometimes to attract diverse candidates that meet those requirements. And people are being mindful of how their department will be impacted long after they leave the position.
So I have a comment. Laura, first of all, thank you for coming today and providing us some insight on this. When Trustee Barsima and I did the presidential listening tour, concerns around this was pretty prevalent. And I would have to tell you, I got the impression it was much greater than 75 individual roles because we were hearing it, you know, over and over again. And we were hearing it in sessions that you wouldn't think, right. but leaders had concerns about the impact of employees that were working for their department, right. and the concern was also how their employees were being notified, and so we heard that we kind of heard it over and over again, and you know, if the state's requiring us to reevaluate these and move people, then we need to do what we have to do, right? But we also need to be pretty mindful of the process, right? And that we're also notifying the leader, we're also notifying the individual that their position has been classified to be or to be reclassified. So just keep that in mind as you continue embarking upon this journey.
Yes, thank you. And that's exactly why we made the determination to send every employee affected in that group of 75 the notification that we're going to work with them on the job description, right. In addition to the supervisor.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So can I make some comments?
Please.
I'm going to do something that I don't usually do, which is I'm going to read something that I'm going to be a little more text here, because I want to be careful about the way that I phrase things. I am going to say things that I think some may think are controversial, but I think they have to be said. So first of all, let me say to Laura and to Celeste and your team that, you know, you've attended to this task with great professionalism, and you've worked hard to explain the steps that must be taken to help both SPS and civil service entities and governing councils, as well as the affected employees, understand these changes and what's required. The process, particularly the need to convert several positions, has caused a good deal of anxiety on campus. And I've met with the SPS Council, both its leadership and the full council, the operating staff personnel advisor, who is also NIU's representative to the Employee Advisory Council, to the Merit Board. I've also met with President Freeman and members of her leadership team who oversee operations that involve SPS positions that are targeted for conversion. There are a number of concerns, including the approaching date of the audit by the system, which I've heard as much as early spring, late spring, as I've heard even the date as late as May. So it may not be as encroaching as we think. Well, hopefully there's a record of that. Mm-hmm. So that's, of course, right at the time, it seems, when we will be attempting to sort out how we're going to address some of these complex conversion questions, and we shouldn't be necessarily we shouldn't be denied the same opportunities to sort these things out in a diplomatic and thoughtful way. The executive director, to be clear, has been clear in his public remarks that he understands there will be challenges ahead, and the system office is willing to work on a plan that allows various time frames for conversion, provided we can establish benchmarks and an agreement on enforcement, whatever that means in practice. He is coming to campus to meet with us, with me and several university leaders in January. In the process of learning about the anxieties this process is causing, I've also learned that there are a number of practices required by the system, as we've discussed, regarding how positions are created and approved, and which constrain the manner in which they are advertised, who is authorized as a finalist, what latitude exists within that framework, that are at the root of concerns over conversion. So they're not just concerns about the process, but also concerns about conversion. In many cases, it matters less how the position is classified as it does what steps need to be taken to hire someone into that position and how much engagement with the rules and HR administration is required before the department or unit manager is able to hire someone. I say that because I want to be clear that I've heard the concerns that irrespective of the conversion mandate, the process is cumbersome and lengthy, and managers at least believe they have less control over the process as they seek to identify the right person in a timely manner. This process also has implications for the university's effort to recruit non-civil service employees like faculty, because there might be a person we wish to hire as a professor, and we need, as part of that effort, to compete by offering employment to a traveling spouse. And these arrangements do not permit us much time to sort out whether that spouse can be hired into a civil service position, often for roles they're ideal for. You can imagine also how this might interrupt other efforts, such as opportunities to hire an enthusiastic faculty of color that has been identified by an academic department, thus curtailing our efforts to diversify the faculty. But more than any other concern, the most significant challenge to this movement to convert so many SPS positions is the impact it might have on the university's programming that is funded through external sources, and I think this is one of the reasons you are seeing so much resistance. We know the story here. As the state funding has waned, universities like NIU have become more entrepreneurial. They have created a number of dynamic, certainly unique programs funded through external sources. These programs, many of them reporting through our Division of Outreach, Engagement, and Regional Development, recruit highly specialized talent demanding compensation comparable to their earning potential in the private sector. We cannot guarantee them a career at NIU, nothing even close to the lifetime appointments we can offer our faculty. So we bring them in as SPS, endeavor to accurately describe what they will do for us, and that permits us to staff these specialized activities and continue to realize the precarious revenue that they bring to our operations. Many of them also are hired in a category we currently call temporary SPS, which means they do not have the same ability to accrue vacation days, as I understand it, and are often hired at higher salaries to account for the impermanent nature of their service. So conversion of these positions produces several challenges that I have had described to me, and I'm going to report them to you as a board. First, a potential payout liability is created because they become eligible for benefits that will likely result in an amount owed to them when they leave. Depending on how a benefit like accrued vacation is calculated, assuming they accrue the maximum, either instantly or as a result of seniority they are recognized to have upon conversion over a shorter period of time, this can result in a payout liability that, added up, is significant. And it would be likely an incentive to forego vacations and sick days, which we all know is not conducive to a healthy work environment. And keep in mind, the funding source for their employment, that grant or contract, does not account for this payout liability. We need to find the money to cover it. The conversion process, secondly, by its very nature, turns a relatively flat operation in terms of who's in charge into a team of people with management-like titles. A research associate or system specialist becomes a program director. Strangely, one of the arguments made by the system leadership is that conversion will somehow reduce the number of administrators, and somehow arguing against conversion is arguing for more administration. But it might actually produce the most rapid increase in middle management administration this university has ever experienced, because to account for the level of skill, talent, and responsibilities these positions require, terms like coordinator, director, manager may be needed to align them to the existing civil service classification. 3, once a former temporary SPS becomes civil service, they and their program become subject to the bumping provisions of the system, which means they can be replaced by another person who holds the same technical position elsewhere but has no specific content experience in or experience with the program. Now, I don't want to overplay this. Bumping is rare, and it requires an alignment that may not be very common in these positions, but it's possible. 4, the newly converted civil service person can also bump into other positions when and if their program grant or contract funding runs out, potentially displacing other civil service employees. 5, the time it takes to establish a civil service position and the limitations on who can be hired, as well as the requirements for how positions are advertised, is feared to be too cumbersome to permit the kind of startup personnel actions required to present ourselves as a suitable applicant for some grants or contracts. Keep in mind, we're often competing for these opportunities against institutions that don't have the same hiring constraints. 6, the final concern translates into a fear that externally funded programming will become too cumbersome and financially risky to perform, and that over time will mean the loss of programming that employs a large number of existing, properly classified civil service employees, administrative assistants, lab technicians, office managers, etc., people that no one ever talked about conversion when they talked about their positions. When that happens, when these some long-service civil servants have to find employment, what will that do to the system? Many of these concerns, although I want to stress the characterizations in these remarks are mine alone, form the basis of concern that has been expressed by several universities. I have even heard internally that this is an existential threat to the institution, and I would assume the same thought would be true of other institutions like ours that have a significant amount of external funding or funded programs. As I've already mentioned, all 9 public university presidents have written a letter asking the system to delay implementation of the new rules. A widely circulated white paper has articulated these concerns and suggested approaches that the system might take to preserve universities' ability to exempt positions outside of the civil service classifications, particularly for grant and contract-funded positions. At its core, the drive to retain flexibility and make the formation and hiring of civil service positions more manageable is the view that the system itself, the statute that underwrites it, assumes a robust state funding of higher education institutions, and this simply is no longer the case. It's not hard to appreciate the validity of this concern when you dive deeper into some of the policymaking and compliance activity of the system office. Take, for example, the recent changes to the administrative code that the system office and merit board submitted in September, which will become law this month, regarding the conditions that must be in place before a university can use a furlough program. In short, these rules require that the controlling board, that's us, must first verify and demonstrate, quote, significant financial distress. And we have 3 available reasons for that distress. We're limited to 1, failure to receive an appropriation. 2, a significant reduction to an annual appropriation. 3, an action by the governor or legislature that sweeps funds or reserves. That's it. Nowhere in this list is the need to adjust to a reduction in tuition, fees, and/or auxiliary enterprise income due to, for example, reductions in enrollment. The failure to contemplate budgetary distress that might involve what in our case is approximately 80% of our revenue sources suggests a disconnect between the system and the realities of funding a state university's operations. There are also audit findings to consider. One of the audits I mentioned earlier in my report, finalized in September of this year, that looked at a period from February 1st, 2014 through July 2017. That's the period, I remind you, that corresponded to the unprecedented failure of the state to pass a budget, the 700 days we often talk about. Another state university was found to have repeatedly violated rules that limit the amount of hours it can employ extra help, which is 900 before a 30-day break in services required. Another finding concerned hundreds of instances of what are called temporary upgrading that went beyond 30 consecutive work days, primarily in building services and the physical plant. The audit concluded that the university, regarding the first, the 900-hour extra help, the audit concluded that the university needed to, quote, conduct an operational analysis to determine if there is a need for the creation of additional status appointments. That means hire more people. The audit concluded in regard to the upgrading issue. Now, keep in mind, the university argued that they needed to properly compensate the employees for performing the higher level work and claimed that they were following the rule. In other words, they contested the audit. But what is important for the point I'm making is that the finding concluded, and I'm quoting again, quote, from a manpower perspective, if employees are upgraded routinely, it usually indicates there is a demonstrated need to reclassify, reallocate, and employ, that means hire, an employee in that position. So in 2018, concerning the manner in which a university sought to address their staffing shortfalls during the most significant budgetary impasse in modern Illinois history, the system office, for all practical purposes, admonished a university for making sure they paid their workers properly and not realizing that they needed to hire more people to perform the work. So suffice it to say, one of my goals as a merit board member is to attempt to convey to the system the needs of today's state universities and participate in a leveling or a balancing of the need for an employment system that offers opportunity and fair working conditions, and for the flexibility of the universities to hire non-traditional, externally funded staff to also fund the operations that those staff work under, many of them that are academic in nature, that are essential to the survival, growth, and quality of public higher education in the state of Illinois.
Can I ask you a question, John? Or Trustee Pritchard? So thank you. That was really comprehensive and wonderful. But what is the conversation in Springfield right now around this? Because this is just law, and then the civil sucks is just implementing and executing and overseeing the statute, right? So what is the conversation in Springfield, and also how unique is Illinois in having a system like this?
So I would just say it hasn't reached the boiling point in Springfield. Mm-hmm. There's too many other issues that leadership hasn't focused on this one, and that's why in earlier conversations with John, we've indicated that we've got to develop a legislative agenda that addresses this and moves forward, finding some support among legislators.
So there's nobody leading this conversation at all right now?
Not the legislature, no.
Which is where it needs to happen if anything has changed.
And how unique is Illinois in having sex? How unique is Illinois in having a system like this? How many other states in the country have civil service?
I haven't seen that kind of data, but must remember that Illinois implemented a number of policies in reaction to some leadership challenges that we've had over the last 15 years.
Sure.
And whether you're looking at this type of civil service modification or whether you're looking at procurement, all of those were severely impacted by the early 2000 situation. And I'll say elected officials have been unwilling to modify that, to pull back from some of the overreaction that obviously occurred. Mm-hmm. And this is typical of what happens in Illinois government, right, is we overreact, and then it takes a longer period of time to come back and modify some of that. But clearly there's cause here and that we need to move aggressively forward to try to modify that.
Thanks.
Are there any other comments on this particular topic? No, this is good informational. We've got another informational document in front of us, and then we got a few action items that we need to take care of. But what I'd like to do, since we've been at it for about 2.5 hours or so, I'd like us to take a 5-minute break. Actually, we'll start up right at 11:30. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and get started, and we'll do Agenda item 7C2. It's another informational item that we have in front of us.
Great. Agenda item 7C2 is the second amendment to Director of Athletics Employment Agreement. And the content of this item is as follows. The university has agreed to extend the contract of its Associate Vice President and Director of Athletics, Sean Frazier, until 2023. This is the second contract extension for Sean. Under the terms of the first contract extension, the university had the option to extend Sean's agreement by providing him with notice between July 1st and August 31st of this year. At about the same time, though, both parties engaged in good faith talks to discuss this ongoing employment relationship. And in the end, the parties reached an agreement on a second amendment to the Director of Athletics Employment Agreement. As you'll see from the document, which was posted with this information item and which is also on my office website in the Clarity and Transparency section, the term of Sean's agreement is extended to June 30th, 2023, and there are modifications to accommodate for those additional years. In addition, there were updates to the duties and responsibilities of the athletic director, including language clarifying the role of the AD under Title IX, as well as standard language from the NCAA regarding the cooperation they expect when conducting investigations. Other than those minor clarifications, the Second Amendment is the same as if the university had exercised the option under the previous agreement. There are no changes in pay, benefits, or other terms or conditions of the employment agreement with Sean. Under Section 2 of the Board of Trustees regulations, the president is authorized to make appointments on behalf of the board of administrative and professional positions other than to vice president or dean positions, which require board approval. I had previously briefed the board in closed session as a personnel matter on the talks about this contract extension and the proposed agreement in principle. Now that we have a final agreement in place, I'm bringing this item to the full board again as an informational item in furtherance of my commitment to transparency in this matter. I want to conclude by saying I am very, very pleased that we were able to retain Sean Frazier as our athletic director. He has been an excellent partner during very challenging times. Sean expects our student athletes to demonstrate excellence in competition, in the classroom, and in the community, and he models the same behavior. He has established a strong compliance program. He has vigorously and successfully pursued opportunities to raise external funds, and he's nationally recognized as an advocate for diversity and inclusion in NCAA athletics. Sean is smart, he's tough, he's relentless, he is a Husky, and we're very fortunate to have him on our leadership team until 2023.
Thank you. Trustees, any comments? I know we had a great discussion about this matter in closed-door session our last meeting. Any public comments anyone would like to make? Yes?
I would just like to say about, you know, as far as Sean is concerned, we've had made the Mac Trophy up here, and everybody always talks about football, and everybody always, you know, that gets a lot of talk. But, you know, we've won the Jacoby Award, which is for the top women's athletic program. We're always, you know, right at the top in terms of grades within our athletic facility. In fact, was it 2 years ago? If there was an article in one of the local papers that if, you know, the National Football Championship was being played based on record and academics, it would have been us against Northwestern. So there's a lot of good things that have come out of that department. And now I know why Sean hugged us for so long after the game. So.
You should have took him to the cigar.
Yeah, exactly. I also would echo the comments that Eric just made. I think success on the field is great, but success in the classroom is, our first priority always. And I think what athletics has done relative to our graduation rate, our GPA, we are consistently at the top of the stack on a nationwide basis from those two standpoints. And I know that's a focus of Sean's. And so very pleased, you know, with the performance so far, and look forward more to come.
Any other comments? So
if anybody hasn't, speaking of our women's programs, our women's basketball program is phenomenal. I think. I mean, I went out to a game, and I had a chance to sit on the floor for just a few minutes with Kathy Doderlein and her mom, rabid fans over there. And we have a great women's basketball team. They're awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. So after we won the MAC championship, I got a phone call from a sports reporter, and he said, "Wheeler, year after year, the football team, all they do is win." He said, "But I'm just surprised that you can't fill that stadium. I just don't understand it." He said, "You know how many schools are itching for a winner like NIU?" And he said, "What is it? Why can't you fill the stadium?" Now, some of you may know that I also got a degree from University of Notre Dame. And I have to tell you, they embrace their sports program. They embrace their student athletes. It's even in their mission statement, right? Every single student gets two tickets to every football game. The professors that have classes on Saturdays, they are getting out of those classes, and they're going to finish up their lessons so they can make sure they don't miss those football games, especially when they have remote classes in the city of Chicago. It is a way of life. They embrace it. It is in their DNA. So 5,000 students on any given Saturday, they got 80,000 people in their stadium. I don't know what it is, but I believe we can't take for granted the fact that we have a winner and we're building a winning legacy. Five championships over the past 12 years or so, really four over the last eight. That's fabulous, and we can't take the greatness that we have for granted. So Sean's not here today. I know he's on the road with one of his student athletes. I think he's scheduled to be back by noon or so. But congratulations, and thank you, Lisa, for making this happen.
All right. Our next agenda item, 7C3, is the fiscal year 19 presidential goals. It is an action item. I will give a little bit of upfront background, but I will ask the board chair to read the recommendation and conduct the vote because of the nature of the item. The presidential contract stipulates that short and long-term goals be established for the leader of this institution. It's done through a process of negotiation between the president and the board of trustees, and it's done so that the institution is transparent about the trustees' priorities and how those translate into action for the president and the leadership team, and to make sure that the trustees' priorities align with the institutional mission, vision, values. And that's part of why we're accredited, because the trustees' vision and our vision are in alignment, and we can link our vision, mission, and values to action and to budget. If you look at the categories in which these goals fall, enrollment, diversity, equity, and inclusion, research, artistry, innovation, and regional engagement, key leadership initiatives that are related to our vision, mission, and values, to hiring key replacements for the leadership team, for making sure that we have a strategic plan for the institution in place and that it aligns with our enrollment plan and our facilities plans and our research plans, and then ensuring fiscal sustainability through good stewardship of public funds and through philanthropic efforts. Those speak to who we are. They reflect what has been said by this board, by the leadership of this institution in many, many forums. When you look at our enrollment goals, they reflect the reality of the changing demographics, the decreased number of high school graduates, the increased competition for both new high school graduates and transfer students, the new majority of learners in this country and this state, first-generation students, students of color, adult learners, veterans, populations that we've historically served well. And they reflect a goal of stabilizing our enrollment initially, around 17,000 to 18,000 students, and using that to inform the rest of our planning efforts. When you look at our goals in terms of not just recruitment but retention, closing the achievement gaps that exist between students of color, first-gen students, students from disadvantaged socioeconomic groups, and the rest of our students, that's the best thing that we can do, not only for retention and to make progress to move that needle, but that's the best thing we can do from a social justice standpoint to serve our students better, to serve the state, and to serve society. This is a goal not only of our institution, but of every university that I'm aware of nationally at this time. That's why one of the manifestations of that goal is to create partnerships so that best practices can be shared and determined how best to scale. When you look at our fiscal sustainability goals, we want to be clear that fiscal sustainability is not just about cutting. It's about having an institution that continues to grow and thrive. So along with having a balanced budget, there's the goal of identifying and implementing a strategic initiatives fund so that we can continue to invest in innovation in a way that will move the university forward. And in terms of philanthropy, scholarship support remains our largest objective. And in addition to unrestricted scholarships, we're recognizing the opportunity to work with our diverse alumni affinity groups to support programs that have served us well and will continue to serve us well. This is the 50th anniversary year of Chance, and a Chance 50th anniversary fund has become part of our overall strategy. If you look at the sheet that's being projected, it's a one-page summary sheet, the background material that provides a little more detail on how the goals will be evaluated follows in the report. This will be posted on the web. And I think at this point, I'll stop and I'll allow discussion or questions from the Board of Trustees. Before I do that, I just want to thank them for being wonderful partners in thinking about what's right for this institution at this time and how to operationalize that.
Okay, fabulous. Let's go ahead and get a motion on the floor, and then we'll open it up for discussions. May I have a motion for approval of the fiscal year 2019 presidential goals? Can I have a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Discussions. Any comments? Anybody?
I would just start off by saying that as we have thought about and as we have discussed in our closed session, there really needs to be focus in our leadership and really all of our employees and the challenges that face our university if we're going to grow to the potential that we have and the goals that we have as well. When we look at what we have outlined here for the objectives and the weight that they carry, clearly enrollment and fiscal sustainability take the leadership. To some degree, I wish they could have been larger. But as I have visited with the president about how she intends to implement and her priorities and goals, I have a lot of confidence that the concerns we have over enrollment and fiscal sustainability are going to be addressed. And I think we have to be innovative in how we do that. So even though there are 25 weights to these various objectives, I think it's very clear in the president's mind, as I have visited with her, as well as in our mind, that these more important priorities will be addressed. And I think in a year from now, we'll be in a much better situation.
Yeah. Thank you, Trustee Pritchett.
Well, I would absolutely echo Bob's comments. A little context that this is a great big step forward from where we've been in the past several years. So I commend President Freeman and the board for taking this step to have a single page, a focused, measurable set of objectives. I, too, wish that could have been heavier weights on the major issues of enrollment and financial sustainability. Those are necessary to actualize our mission, for sure. And it creates, to me, hyper-focus is really, really healthy. That said, I do as well have confidence that we are collectively keeping our eye on the biggest target that's necessary. So progress for sure. I can't wait to see us exceed these numbers as we sit here a year from now and cheer the success.
Any other comments?
I would just encourage everybody in this room and outside of the room to understand these goals, because I know as any great leader, Lisa will now make these your goals. So I think this represents, and again, I applaud Lisa, and I know Matt Streb had, a strong role in this as well as I'm sure in a number of other folks, but I applaud Lisa for going through this exercise in a very collaborative way with the board so that all of our requests and all of our sense of urgencies are represented, maybe not in the, some we may want weighted more than others, but at the end of the day, those are the urgencies of the university and of the board, and I think we are in good alignment. So thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. Good job. Good question. Yes, Trustee.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind the broad way in which we have contextualized and defined some of these initiatives as related to the bottom line. And if I'm doing my math correctly, which I never do, we're 60% or so if we add fiscal sustainability, research, regional engagement, and enrollment, which if we monetize those activities.
65%.
Actually, 68%, because okay. The collaborate to close achievement gap goals appears twice, and it gets an additional 3% for the social justice piece under diversity, equity, and inclusion. So enrollment is actually 28%.
Okay. And so that, I mean, it's...
Not that I know that or anything.
Right. Well, so it's weighted fairly heavily on the things that drive the operating budget and keep the lights on and make us competitive as a choice for students.
You're too. This is something that was probably only a twinkling in everyone's eyes a couple of years ago. And now we're seeing this reality. So I think, it's transparency, alignment is so vitally important to running an organization.
again, everybody can say, well, geez, I wish we had a higher goal for enrollment and things like that. But this is realistic, I think. And this gives us something to build off of and helps to, I think, bring some momentum.
If I could just say one more thing about the enrollment goal. The leadership convened two retreats over the summer. We've been working since then with the Strategic Enrollment Management Committee. We've created a model and a strategic enrollment management plan that's just about in final form for release. That'll be shared with the leadership this month and more widely across the campus as the new semester begins and people return refreshed. And the goals here reflect the goals of that plan and the work of many, many people who care deeply about this institution and are committed to its future.
That's a line, and that's awesome. Good luck.
Yes, Butler, Trustee Butler.
I want to add to Trustee Wasowitz's remarks. I think as the former chair of the board and having gone through a couple years' worth of presidential goal setting, this is really one of Wheeler's legacies. I mean, he really... working with Lisa really pulled this together over a lot of iterations, a lot of conceptualization, and I have great appreciation for the final result because there is such a excellent level of transparency here about where the institution is going as a result of it.
So thank you, Trustee Butler. I will say this. This was a lot of heavy lifting. The whole concept of at-a-glance goals took on many iterations. We had a Christmas tree here at one point in time with red, yellow, and green also. And Lisa said, we got to get rid of the color. but I will tell you, this has been a collaborative effort, input from a lot of the board members as well as administration. I also want to point out to you, 7 years ago, we didn't have goals. So we've come a long way. And our hope is to continue to see these goals pushed out throughout the organization where every leader has a set of goals in front of them that are aligned with what they do and aligned with the goals at the highest level. I'd love for people to perceive this and think of this as the university goals, not necessarily just Lisa's goals. And I think this is an item that will help carry us and drive us and drive our actions every single day as people make hundreds of decisions every single day to move the university forward, making sure that they're properly aligned with what we have in front of us. If Trustee Struthers.
Yeah, I was going to add, since John spoke twice, I thought maybe I could. On the enrollment piece as well, I think for the benefit of administration and the entire university public, we had a lot of heavy debate about the enrollment numbers, and we landed at what would appear on paper to be, you know, somewhat flat with where we've been. You know, our hope is that we can exceed those targets and come out of the gate with some success for sure. We absolutely are aware that ISU has gained freshman enrollment, UIC has, and Eastern had a great year last year. We're aware of all of that as well as the massive demographic trends that Lisa talked about. So there's a piece that would have been in discussion about, boy, do you have really robust targets and put everything behind this thing and try to hit those higher goals. And so I just think that for the benefit of all of us in this room, right, that was discussed at a pretty meaningful and serious level. And by no means is this considered easy. You know, we think we want to, you know, bounce off the bottom, get this, have a victory, and then get the momentum and get up. Absolutely is a priority. So I think just for context, again, that when someone looks at the historic, you know, the new freshman enrollment and the new transfer numbers year to year, this on paper looks like it's business as usual. We see it as anything but that, and there's been a lot of work behind that in discussion.
Thank you. there are no more comments, I'd like us to take a vote on this. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion is approved.
Our next action item directly from the president is item 7C4, Northern Illinois Center for Community Sustainability Capital Project Approval. And you may remember that when we approved the center in concept earlier, I alluded to the fact that there would be an additional item coming forward today. As I noted earlier, the RILA committee endorsed moving forward with NICS during the November committee meetings, and we approved that today. The board approved that today. The request here is approval for funding associated with the design phase of the building. The timeline is preliminary at this point, but aiming for completion in 2021-22, this approval that request right here is seeking funding for the design efforts to take place in calendar year 2019. The request is for money that will be flowing from the Illinois DCEO grant in an amount just over $2 million. We expect to receive the first phase of this funding from DCEO prior to the end of the calendar year, and the initial funding will be enough to cover the $2 million design phase request. We will, as a university, come back to FACFO at future meetings to secure approval for funding in support of construction. The reason we're coming forward to support approval now is so we can begin efforts to secure architect in January. I've already talked about where the overall funding for the project is going to come from in response to Trustee Barsima's comment earlier, so I think I'll just leave it there and give the university's recommendation, which is that the Board of Trustees authorize proceeding with a project that includes work orders, all necessary contracts with consultants, contractors, and suppliers as necessary to proceed with the design efforts and contracted project management support for this research hub in an amount not to exceed what's noted, $2,020,000.
May I have a motion to approve the capital project for NICS?
So moved.
Get a second?
Second.
Any discussions?
By way of clarification, what's the timeline for actually having the building functioning?
We hope that we will be able to open the building in 2021, at least in part. We expect the building to be fully functional in 2022.
Have we, Lisa, under the laws of the state, selected an architect to do the architectural drawings? And if so, who?
No, we will be following our procurement rules to do an appropriate.
Okay, so we haven't gone through. Okay, so
we generally have approval from the board for the amount before we proceed with seeking a contractor.
How long do we expect that to take, and when do we think we'll actually have an architect that'll be designing? Any guesses?
We'd like to start now so that we can secure an architect by the end of January.
Okay, so 60 days or so.
Okay. Any other questions? Let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Hearing none, the motion approved. The motion is approved.
Our next agenda item is 7C5, request for agreement and delegated authority regarding the Northern Illinois University Press. The university is requesting authority to enter into an agreement with the Cornell University Press for production of NIU Press books. NIU will continue acquisition and editorial board functions, while the Cornell University Press will manage manuscript editing, design, production, marketing, and fulfillment of 15 to 25 books per year under the NIU imprint. We anticipate a formal agreement to be completed in early 2019 with a term of 5 years and an option for 5 additional years. So the contract will be, I want to make this clear, initially 5 years with an option for 5 one-year extensions. The first year will be about $100,000. Each of the next 4 years, $80,000 per year, so $420,000 total. This is above the $250,000 approval limit, and which is why we're coming to the board now to ask for this authorization. We are nearly complete in terms of an understanding with the Cornell University Press, and delegation of authority will initiate the final negotiations. So to read the recommendation, the university requests Board of Trustees authorization to enter into the proposed agreement with Cornell University Press, consistent with the program goals outlined above, once final details and terms are negotiated. The authorization shall be delegated to the president for final signature on the agreement. The president shall report to the board when the final agreement is executed and the final terms and conditions of the agreement are known. So what I gave you is what's likely, but obviously we're not completely done with negotiations. If the terms and conditions of the proposed arrangement deviate substantially from the program goals and framework, the president will return the matter to the board for consideration of substantial modifications.
So let's get a motion on the floor to approve the authorization regarding Northern Illinois University Press. Can I get a motion, please?
So moved.
Get a second?
Second.
Discussions? Yes, Trustee Butler.
President Freeman, will it still say this is a publication of the Board of Trustees of Northern Illinois University?
That is our imprint, but the actual mention of the board, I'm looking to Dr. Blasey to make sure that that will remain.
Because I love being a publisher and don't want that to end.
Yes, we can do that.
Okay.
Well, then we can all go ahead with this.
Do we have any sense for why there were no responses to the RFP and why we're just to be sole source?
Academic publishing is a very specialized field. Uh-huh. And so our imprint and what this university is known for, actually not just nationally but internationally, is expertise in Orthodox religion, Russian history, and some areas of scholarly work that the Cornell University Press also has great expertise in. So for other presses who don't have interest in our imprint because they don't have the reputation, knowledge, authors, we will enhance Cornell and Cornell will enhance us. This will also save us money. Whereas it might be possible that we would have saved money by, you know, another press coming forward, they didn't see the value proposition that the Cornell University Press saw in this acquisition. We believe this is a wonderful deal. Jerry, I'm going to ask you if you want to comment any on that.
There's tremendous alignment between the series that the two presses publish in Slavic and Orthodox studies. They're probably considered the best presses in the world. And for us to get in a collaborative arrangement with Cornell means that we will attract better manuscripts, mm-hmm. because we will build on each other's reputation. Marketing is already in place, which is really important. There's specific conferences that they attend and that we attend. Just the quality and the marketing will both improve or be stronger because it's Cornell Press.
Great, thanks. I just wanted a little bit more if we're going to be approving sole source. Thank you.
Jerry, I have a couple of questions. How do we determine which 15 or 20 manuscripts that we're going to get behind and publish?
So we will retain editorial acquisition here at NIU, and basically the editor is on the lookout, solicits manuscripts, and also receives them. So 15 is about the right number for these two titles. We have an agreement with Cornell that if there is enough quality, if there are enough quality manuscripts submitted, we can go as high as 25.
I see. And we have an editorial board internally to the university.
Yeah, we will retain both editorial acquisitions, and the editorial board will then review the acquisitions, which is sort of a quality control. And then they actually are the ones that put forward the books to the Cornell Press.
I see. In terms of decommissioning the equipment and our current operation, what does that look like and what's the impact?
So everything's printed by contractors. So the only equipment we're talking about here are bookcases and computers. And it's not without coincidence that most of the computers are near the end of their lifetime. So there's very little decommissioning. We do have a warehouse out on the Monsanto campus that houses several thousand books that we will have to pulp. And then we have some space that we can think about how to better utilize it.
Okay. Trustee Butler, when are we going to write our book?
As soon as I learn something about Russian history.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
When it says here the funding, the total costs are anticipated to be over $250, so that's a hurdle for us there. I mean, usually we see something that's not to exceed or something along those lines.
So the request here is for delegation to the president. Because we are aware that it will be over $250,000, I tried to give reassurance by saying what we anticipate based on our current negotiations is about $420,000, although those negotiations aren't complete.
Okay.
On that. So that's $420,000 that we would outlay over 5 years. Our negotiations have reached the point where I believe we're going to see something like as much as $50,000 in royalty returns back to the university if certain profit levels are exceeded by our titles. So it could be less than the $420,000. It may be more like $300,000.
Well, and in any case, maintaining our imprint through this arrangement will save the university between $150,000 and $200,000 a year without the royalty returns.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Great. No other questions? Let's go ahead and take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes.
Agenda item 7C6 is an action item entitled Convocation Center Update, Nelson Suite Capital Project Amendment. So we may look back and remember that the board reviewed a budget of $275,000 funded by a donor gift at the FACFO meeting on February 15th of 2018 and then approved that item at the full board meeting in March, on March 8th of 2018. During the renovation of the Nelson Suite, a structural misalignment was identified and adjustments had to be made to accommodate the change. There were no safety concerns. There's no concern about structural soundness. It was merely a misalignment of blueprints showing where items like I-beams ought to be. So demolition plans had to be modified accordingly due to the error in the blueprint. Here we are requesting $25,000 to cover the overage needed to adjust the construction plan so that the plan aligns with the existing footprint. We anticipate using auxiliary funds, and we're still aiming for a January reopening to align with the start of basketball conference play. So the recommendation is that the university request the Board of Trustees authorization to increase the project budget and proceed with the project that includes work orders, all necessary contracts with consultants, contractors, and supplier as necessary to complete the work. The donor funds, $275,000, were previously approved as I described, and we're asking here for the additional $25,000 as an amendment.
May I have a motion to approve the update Nelson Suite Capital Project Amendment?
So moved.
Second.
And a motion and a second. Any discussions? Seeing none, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes.
Agenda item 7C7 is also an action item, the Yordan Nutrition Center and Weight Room Improvements Capital Project Approval. Athletics has been actively fundraising, donor funding provided by alumni, donors, and a leadership gift from Northwestern Medicine. These were announced on October 3rd, 2018. Seeking approval now in support of completion of the Nutrition Center in March with weight room enhancements completed by early June. The $275,000 proposed budget incorporates a contingency, as do all projects. These are susceptible to changing market conditions, but we believe that this is a best estimate given what we know about this renovation project that will improve signage equipment, cosmetic improvements, and actually provide our student athletes with something that's much needed in terms of the nutrition center to support their health and wellness. The recommendation is that the university request the Board of Trustees authorization to proceed with a project, including all work orders, necessary contracts with consultants, contractors, and suppliers as necessary to complete the work.
At this point in time, we need a motion to approve the Jordan Nutritional Center and weight room improvements.
So moved.
Need a motion. Can I have a second?
Second.
Any comments?
Can I just ask a clarifying question, Lisa? So this is going to be now called the Northwestern Medical Performance Center, yet the title says the Jordan Nutrition Center and Weight Room. Should or have we titled this action item correctly?
I believe the Jordan in the title just refers to the building, but I'll look to John Heckman for clarification on that.
I think the best explanation I can give is this has evolved as the project kind of originated. It was talked about nutrition center, and then as athletics wanted to include the weight room in the overall center concept, I think we were kind of late to thinking, oh, we probably should change the project title. But the naming is about the performance center, which includes a nutrition center and the weight room concept
as well.
Right,
so this is a naming opportunity for Northwestern Medical in addition to the capital improvements to the weight room and the nutrition center itself. Okay, I just wanted to be clear on that.
Because of the lead gift among the other funding.
Right.
Yes.
And a question for you as well.
So as far as the nutritional area is concerned, nutrition experts to meet the demands, is this something that our nursing school or anything?
Our dietetics program will be actively involved.
Okay. All right. Great.
And, you know, again, I just want to say I assume that this is a continuation or an offshoot of the discussions that we've been having with Northwestern Hospital. I think this is wonderful for them to step forward with this naming gift, and it's awesome.
You know, I think that we and Northwestern are big employers in this community, and as a result, we have a lot of impact. We have a business arrangement with them that was approved at the last full board meeting, but we've had a philanthropic arrangement with them that preceded and that will continue.
Great.
That's great. Any other comments? All right, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes.
Okay, I'm afraid to use the word final agenda item here, but I do believe the last action item directly from the president is agenda item 7C8, a recommendation for honorary doctorates. As you know, NIU can honor individuals with doctoral degree conferral at the graduate school graduation. There is a formal nomination and committee process. The honorary degree committee met on November 12th to consider the candidacy of three nominees and unanimously recommended two, Mr. Dean Ducray and Dr. Marcia Grant, for honorary doctorate degrees. Dean Ducray was nominated by Dean Balaji Rajagopalan of the College of Business with support from Dr. Rebecca Shortridge, the Chair of Accountancy, and Jim Young, the former Chair of Accountancy. Mr. Ducray is an NIU alum, a successful businessman and philanthropist. Dr. Marcia Grant was nominated by Dr. Laura Beamer, Associate Professor in the School of Nursing, with support from Dr. Marilyn Stromberg, Professor Emeritus. Dr. Grant is a Fellow of the American Academy of Nursing, the recipient of over $35 million in external grants, and the author of more than 300 scholarly publications. Our recommendation from the university is that the Board of Trustees approve to award an honorary doctorate in humane letters to Mr. Dean Ducray and an honorary doctorate in science to Dr. Marcia Grant.
All right, we need a motion for agenda item 7C8, the honorary doctorate recommendation. May I have a motion, please? Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussions? Seeing none, let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion passes.
This concludes the president's report, or the items directly from the president.
Great. So at this point in time, agenda item 8, the chair's report 88. We have agenda item 8A, closed session minutes, review and release. May I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Can I get a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, this item traditionally comes through a recommendation from the Office of General Counsel. My office is not recommending any release of the closed session minutes at this time, yet we will continue to discuss these items in closed session as we're allowed under the Open Meetings Act, because the board has to do this on a twice a year basis. And so I just wanted to put that into the record.
So point of order, should we be taking a vote on this or not?
Yes, because we've had discussions about our closed session minutes in prior closed sessions.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Thank you. Any comments on any concerns from anybody? Any comments? No? If not, then let's go ahead and let's take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion is approved. Agenda item number 9, other matters. Are there any other matters that need to come before this group? One comment I'd like to make is that since it's before 1 o'clock, we do have time to take pictures with the trophy. And so I know all these social media folks out there that have their own little Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram accounts. I'm sure you want to post a picture of yourself with the trophy, and so that will be made available. I think the trustees, we should take a group picture with that trophy if you guys I've got a few minutes right before we go into closed session. All right, agenda item number 10, the next meeting date. The next regularly scheduled meeting of the Board of Trustees will be held March 7th, 2019. Our new chair, Barsima, will oversee that meeting in March. Agenda item number 11, closed session. The board needs to go into closed session. We do not plan to take up any new business following the closed session. May I have a motion to close the public meeting to conduct a closed session to discuss the following subject authorized by the Illinois Open Meetings Act. Personnel matters as generally described under Section 2C, 1, 2, 3, and 21 of the Open Meetings Act. Collective bargaining matters as generally described under Section 2C2 of the Open Meetings Act. Property matters as generally described under Section 2C5 and 6 of the Open Meetings Act. Litigation and risk management matters as generally described under Section 2C11 and 12 of the Open Meetings Act. Closed session minutes matters as generally described under Section 2C21 of the Open Meetings Act. May I get a motion, please?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Ms. Dulles, will you please take a roll call?
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Nathan Hayes?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero?
Yes.
Trustee Bob Pritchard?
Yes.
Trustee Tim Struthers?
Yes.
Trustee Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Vice Chair Dennis Barsima?
Yes.
Board Chair Wheeler Coleman?
Yes. This open meeting is closed. We're going into closed session. Thank you. It is 2:54. We just came from closed session. It is currently December the 6th, 2018. At this point in time, can I get a motion to close?
So moved.
I'm sorry. Do I need a roll call?
Vice Chair Dennis Barsema.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Nathan Hayes.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero.
Here.
Trustee Bob Pritchard. Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Trustee Eric Wasowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Wheeler Coleman.
Here. So we're all here. We're all in open session again. At this point in time, can I get a motion to close?
So
a motion, you got a second?
Second.
A motion is second. We need a roll call to close. All those in favor of closing, say aye.
Aye.
This meeting is adjourned.